So I was wondering why Chris was looking at me. Chris just kept track of who's going. Well, good morning, Chris. It's you've got the floor.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. It's good to be here. I've been looking forward to this for
your whole career.
13 months or something like that. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Chris Boswell, Director of the Department of Administration and Information. To my right, Rory Horsley, who heads our accounting efforts within the director's office. Behind me in various spots are the administrators for the Department of Administration and Information, including Joyce Heffenheider, who's the deputy director, Leslie Boughton, who is the state librarian, Dean Fawcett, I hope, is back there somewhere, who adds human resources. I'm just going to hope they've got my back, Mr. Chairman. Brett Jones is secreted over in the corner, as usual. Rich Cathcart, Brett, of course, runs the budget division. Rich Cathcart heads up general services and construction management. I would also note that I believe Ralph Hayes, who represents and runs Employees Group Insurance, is back there because I assume we're going to spend some time in that section of the ANI budget. And finally, last but not least, by any means, I believe Buck McVeigh, who runs economic analysis for the state of Wyoming. I left Buck for last, first of all, because the Craig report is half of his responsibility. So if you have problems with that tomorrow, I think you should feel free to blame Buck. And secondly, because I'm happy for Buck, but sad for the rest of us that Buck has announced that he will be retiring on February 3rd. It's likely that I will appoint an interim director, but we will miss him. I didn't know that somebody that's 40 years old could have that many years of experience in state government. I think he looks a little younger than that, so it's a little irritating to think that he actually qualifies for state retirement. But so be it.
You'd jump a shipping a sinking ship, wouldn't you?
The SSANI will move forward, Mr. Chairman. A quick note in terms of I'll toss out the way I'm thinking today might go, knowing full well that it won't go that way. But we'll spend some time, obviously, on the ANI budget. We're also scheduled to work 6A and 6B, the ANI-supported boards, and then the independent boards. I must tell you, Mr. Chairman, that I believe there may be one or two boards represented here today, but for the most part, my message to them has been what I would say is realistic, in that I think that your time is very compressed. I'm not sure how much time the committee will want to spend on 6A and 6B. There are certainly folks that are interested in this process. There are very few general fund requests in either 6A or 6B. In fact, there are only two for a very small amount of money. For the most part, these boards are, to some degree, stewards of their own funds, although that requires legislative approval. So again, it's I'll present the budgets in as limited a fashion as you might like, Mr. Chairman. So we'll see how time permits and the desire of the committee in terms of how much detail we go into on the ANI supported boards and the independent boards. Mr. Chairman, I believe in front of you in your inboxes would be the usual assortment of reports that the committee has requested, a rundown of the 600 and 900 series expenditures for the 11 and 12 biennium, a note on possible impacts of federal funds cuts, which are very difficult to gauge in an agency like ANI, because the direct federal fund appropriations within ANI are really only housed in plain sight in the library division. But obviously, when we talk about leases, when we talk about employees group insurance, and a variety of other subjects, there are federal funds that course through the cost allocation process that wander in and out of multiple agency budgets and also through ANI. So it's a little difficult to pinpoint effects of federal reductions, federal funding reductions on ANI at this point. So I believe you see a fairly brief memo to you on federal funds. You'll also see the 10-year employment history for the agency, which suggests that the agency has grown a bit from 10 years ago, but has remained essentially constant since the numbers of FTEs since roughly 2004. If you were of a mind to head over to the right-hand column and the number of AWAC employees in the Department of Administration over the years, you'll see that there are some fairly wide swings of those numbers. Most recently, what would that be, two or three years ago, relative to the newspaper project through the library, which involved an enormous effort of researching, scanning newspapers, historic newspapers in the state of Wyoming. That involved quite a number of AWAC employees. That's the big jump there. Now we're down to less than 10 AWACs in ANI. I'm just going to keep rolling, knowing full well, Mr. Chairman, that any time you folks want, you'll jump in and I'll shut up. Mr. Chairman, also I'll draw your attention to the document, which I believe you have, which outlines the proposed cuts in the Department of Administration and Information as requested by, in various forms, the governor and this committee, the 2%, 5%, and 8% cut document to the standard general fund standard budget for ANI. If you don't mind, I'll just run through that very quickly because it is illustrative, if you will, of some areas in the ANI budget that you're going to be working today. First of all, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, ANI, through the governor's recommendations, will reach both the 2% and 5% general fund standard budget cuts in this budget as you see it in front of you with the governor's recommendations. That's primarily accomplished. Well, I won't go into those details, but I'll just leave it at that. Mr. Chairman, we'll talk about it in a few minutes. The 8% cuts, Mr. Chairman, involve elimination of a vacant position in the director's office, an admittedly theatrical move to reduce my own salary, but I think it's still appropriate. Some reductions at surplus property, small reductions there. And then you'll see on that list the first of what I believe are four positions that are currently filled. At least the way I would describe it is I'm not identifying a specific position, but I would eliminate a position from Central Mail, and all those positions are currently filled. I would eliminate a position in facilities operations. That's probably likely to be known to all of us as the janitorial staff. I would propose the reduction of janitorial housekeeping supplies budgets, a reduction of utilities appropriations, a position in construction management, the elimination of, as you'll see there, $50,000 in contractual services in construction management. We can drop the budget without too much trouble in terms of real property rental because it is likely that the fifth floor of the Hathaway building will be ready for occupancy probably, if Mr. Cathcart can correct me, but I believe it would be at the end of 2013. So we can take a quarter of the lease space costs for school facilities department and the Community College Commission, which would be moving up to that fifth floor if all goes well. But I would propose to reduce the intern program funding by 50%. My thought is that if agencies, I think it sends a bad message to eliminate the intern program, but I think agencies have the flexibility within their budgets. If they choose to hire interns, they can do so on their own rather than through a central pot of money. But again, we would still retain a a portion of that historic appropriation. We would propose to eliminate the amount in the standard budget for funding for work with a Hay Group. Again, it's likely that we might well need the contract with the Hay Group in the future, but it's my thought that we don't have to have money in the standard budget for that. And very significantly, Mr. Chairman, up front in economic analysis, I would offer, I guess, or propose the elimination of the Wyoming Economic and Socioeconomic Program, the WESP program. That is a program that was initiated at legislative direction within the last year. There is one person in that program, so what we've done with this is identified basically a position that ties directly to a person almost by name. And I hesitated to do that, but it's a new program, and if we're going to be cutting, belief that program is worth considering for elimination in tough economic times.
Chairman, do you know which handout we're dealing with?
I think that's one of the other ones that's on probably on our scan documents, but probably not. Probably got distributed earlier.
Yeah, I can't
find it. So it's on your thumb drive, but and we'll when we talk about the budget and the from A and I's from a budgetary position on the new governor's budget, do you have in your mind's eye what the total operating general fund increase is in dollars and approximate range?
Mr. Chairman, ongoing?
Yeah.
I believe that yes, I do know what that is, but I'm going to have to ask Mr. Jones in terms of the number. I don't think there is a significant increase to the operating budget for the state as a whole, in part because much of the governor's exception requests take the form of one-time exceptions, and similarly there have been reductions to the standard that balance overall. But
I have in my mind that there's probably a 4 or 5% increase built in between health and other agencies. A bunch of agencies have been flatlined. Health is, I'm not sure whether it's 4 to 6% increases, but I'm not sure about that. I mean, we'll get our numbers. Brett, when you look at just your operating increases without CapCon and those things, what's the total dollar amount that's out there for agencies? And then what we ought to do is lump in not only the one-time operatings and the operating itself.
Mr. Chairman, I do not have that number immediately available. I will tell you that in the context of what the governor proposed overall, there was a reduction in the standard budget. I know your question is more related to operating, but it's very dependent upon, as Mr. Boswell indicated, on the definition of one-time funding across all of the exception requests associated overall.
Well, one of the things that as we look down from a budgetary and concept, it makes no sense to say, okay, we're going to look for 4-8% increases. And let's take Department of Health. Tell Department of Health, we're going to give you a 3 or 4% increase, and give us back 4%, 8% reductions. And in the governor's budget, as you have them coded through, the issue is if we flatlined everybody at the standard budgets and said, look, this beginning place is flatline. Obviously, the agency that would have the biggest concern would be health, that has some built-in cost of living increases, things like that. But even if you're doing, if we're really serious that we cannot afford increases, it makes no sense to say health, go ahead and spend another X percent, and we want X percent back from you at the same time. And at the same time, we'll hear what Buck and Mr. Mai have to say about the Craig tomorrow, but last night gas prices are down at the old Powell hub there, or there at the Henry hub, they were under at about 270, and they were lower at old Powell. And we all know the impacts of that. So I guess as we begin to, for me, the challenge is to try to figure out realistic where we are, but I think we kind of came into this budget thinking that we were going to have to see demand some decreases. But we do have increases, and it doesn't make sense to give the increases and then turn around and demand decreases. And I guess over the next week and a half, I think the challenge for us, our staff and your staff, is to say, first of all, let's assume that we are going to have to seek decreases. If so, then what happens if we flatline everybody? Just nobody gets any money. Now, I still think there's a demand in our constituencies for capital construction, for highways, for things like that, and that's part of what we're trying to do. But so I guess I would like, over the course of the next week and a half, if your budget staff would think about what happens if we fell out line. What are the consequences to it? Obviously, nobody's going to like it, but nobody's going to like 8% cuts either.
Mm-hmm.
And if we flatline everybody, then the next question is, do we need to do further decreases over the course of the next 2 to 4 years? And just thinking out loud, it seems to me that if we flatline everybody, perhaps we then go back and say, we'd like to see 2 to 4% decreases in your budget for the next supplemental budget. And we'd like to have your final budget for coming into the next biennium a total of 8% lower, so you're essentially picking up 4% a year. And then each agency meet with their oversight legislative committees to discuss where these cuts are. So instead of having agencies, for example, we would be meeting with you, and at the end of the day, if you say, here's our 4% cut, and if you want to take a salary cut, we'd have that discussion. But it would be a joint discussion rather one presented to one way. So with respect to health, they would be meeting with the Labor Oversight Committee, meeting with them to say, okay, what cuts is the legislature? We want to participate in shaping these cuts. But the in the end, I guess we have to agree on that we're bound by the Craig estimates, and being bound by the Craig estimates, then we'll, as of tomorrow, we'll have new updates, and then the challenge is how do we get here, not only this biennium, but the next biennium. And but I guess part of my question to you then is, and I've discussed with you these ideas, they're not fresh to you, but they may be fresh to some of the folks on the JAC. What do you think, and how do you see the best way to forge through, from a budgetary point of view, these big issues and trying to get to bring our budget in line with our revenues?
Mr. Chairman, that's a $64,000 question if there ever was one. My experience would suggest, first of all, as you've noted, any sort of across-the-board, hold-the-line type calculation needs to keep in mind the political realities of budgeting, and brings up the very basic question that you've asked, which is, on the one hand, we've got exception requests that are raising budgets, while at the same time we propose to reduce standards, and how do you reconcile those two? I think realistically, I'm not sure that what you're suggesting is accomplished by memo. I think it is accomplished by meeting and dialogue among the folks that are tasked with making these sorts of decisions. I do think there is enough time to do this in the next literally few days. I'm not sure that momentum is underway yet, because, to be honest with you, I think the question of what the Craig numbers may be tomorrow is going to significantly change the way people look at this budget. And the drop in natural gas prices and the expectation over the years, which I think probably existed for the past few months, but the expectation that's now eroding, that perhaps as prices typically have in the past, they would rebound in the foreseeable future. You know, we all sit around and wonder, and I think it's kind of incredible to think of it this way, but whether there's going to be a cold snap and natural gas prices go up, and we can all say that's a crazy way to run a state budget. But, you know, the fact is things like that happen, and things like that do change dramatically the nature of the prices that we get for our minerals. So it's a roundabout way of saying and not too pie in the sky. I think there's a need for folks to get together and talk about this if you will, off-camera settings.
We'll be doing that. We left health to the end for reasons, including making sure that by the time we can see the Department of Health that we've got a better understanding of our budget. We understand that Director Forslund has a tough job already with the budget he has proposed. It hasn't made him very popular, but having said that, the question that that we'll be asking and the discussion is really what happens if we flatline, and obviously you hold a budget. We're doing that with schools. And there's folks that would have said, how can you possibly flatline school budgets? But we're doing it. We're flatlining a variety of budgets. And I understand that health is the most vulnerable people in our community, but we need to have the discussion. And like I say, it makes not a lot of sense to say, well, we'll give you an increase now, but come back and give us a bigger decrease. The other thing, while we've got A and I here, and we've got the budget folks here, on the budget books, let's take a look at page 8. These summaries are great. They're the department priority summaries, and we've got now the habit of having all the agencies put them in the front of the books, and it's great. We appreciate it. You're doing that. Question is this, can we... in future budgets, could we add two more columns to it? And the one column that I would like to have, if we could, is whether or not on the department where we have the dollar figure. What we don't have is any representation of whether it's a general fund or other fund. And if we could add another column that would tell us the other fund. And then the last one, which is more complicated, ask you if we can do that for permanency, is to add an additional column that gives the Gov's rec on that item. Now, what happens is by the time you guys print, you have all of the Gov's recs embedded in it. So my assumption is by that time you can have the Gov's rec in a last column. And my question to you is, now having gone back to prepare the budgets, is it an easy enough thing to have that prepared?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it is. Without looking at the budget, folks, I believe it is. Obviously, it involves a little bit of drafting sort of work, but I don't think that's especially if there isn't a lot of my short answer, Mr. Chairman, is yes.
I don't think we have to. I mean, if the governor has significant different, but the more we learn how to present it this way, the more helpful it is.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill, while you guys were out determining our future, I assume, collaborating and discussing whether our gas prices are going to hold at $8 or not.
They prayed for snow.
$8, yeah. Last night I was telling, I saw it was at 270 or something at the Opal, Henry and lower at Opal. But what I was asking is looking at the budget of page 8, whether or not it would be difficult to have A&I in the standard formatting make it a modification to where We add in the source of the funding. So, for example, when you're looking here, you say $133 million, a spending authority increase. I know that that's not a general fund request. And if I look down below, I could see that you've got $90 million of general fund request. But in the columns, I don't know which source generates the general fund. And I'm really mostly interested in the general fund on the summary sheet. So if we could add a column just to put the fund source, and then also then finally in putting adding additional column to just show just the gov's rec on the approved or not approved with a total dollar amount. Now, it gets a little complicated because obviously the gov's recs go beyond the priority list that the agency had. And it may be that we say, I mean, I don't know whether we ought to have a summary there because I don't want the list to get cluttered with other gov's recs throughout the budget. At the same time, if we just know if it's approved or approved, and then maybe a subparagraph of the agency priorities, what's the total general fund? I don't have the perfect answer to it because I don't want to create confusion because you flip to the next page, the summary, it has that really the entire agency. But this is a great tool that's been developed. I think we can make it a little more useful. And then if we get that, if the budget office would then maybe re-prepare that and maybe show how it looks so we can kind of get a feel for what it looked like. But I'm finding these sheets are great. They just have some missing information. All right, Chris, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I just see that as very doable. Details to follow. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as we launch into Agency 6, one thing to keep in mind is that for the purposes of this budget, the Office of the Chief Information Officer and the IT division of ANI have been separated out. This is for budget purposes. After some discussion with you folks back in the summer and fall, you'll see that now in Agency 306. I'll tell you, as I've told this committee before, Mr. Chairman, I have largely handed over responsibility for ITD to Mr. Waters. Had those discussions with Governor Mead, and I think it's just a whole lot better idea to have somebody that knows what ITD means to be making many of the day-to-day decisions. Flint and I speak on a very constant basis. I'm just very glad that we have him here and that he is in charge of that section of state government. So, Mr. Chairman.
That's a good segue just to talk about a little bit. We'll talk about Flint in front of him. The issue that concerns me that I kind of like your input in, and that is the centralization of ITD services. I think we all agree that in an ideal world you have this marriage of centralization to create improvements and lower costs, and we know we need to do that. But having said that, I can't ignore the fact that almost every agency that comes in has an ITD guy there, and when they come up and they present to us, they seem to be extraordinary leaders, bright people with great ideas. And so in my mind's eye, if the goal is to consolidate all those functions and bring all those people in as a group, I wonder how you maintain that. I mean, those folks are there partly because they're supervisors. They're there partly because they're charged with innovation. They answer directly to a director. There's some excitement for that position, and when you consolidate those functions back into ANI, you change that dynamic. And do we retain those high quality people in doing that? And we may have to do that regardless, just because of cost. But I guess when you look at it from the outsider seeing it move away from you, what do you think about bringing those people in over the long haul? Do we lose a set of skill sets that we have now, or how do we preserve that skill set?
Mr. Chairman, in my former life in the last administration, Rob Herlis used to describe the current IT functions for the state of Wyoming as balkanized, and it was absolutely right. You had everybody off doing their own thing. We all recognized that it was a problem. We all recognized that we didn't have a particular solution because there isn't one solution. Mr. Chairman, I think you accurately describe some of the challenges that lie ahead as if the consolidation does proceed. And obviously Flynn will give you a far better perspective from where he comes from. But, Mr. Chairman, I just think it's necessary. We've got too many agencies off doing their own thing. We're paying too many people to do sometimes extremely bright people to do work. That work completes, and they're still in the agency, and there they sit. We've got master service agreements all over the place that are extremely expensive, and you just get the sense from an amateur like from the perspective of an amateur like me that there is a better way to do this. It is going to be uncomfortable for certain agencies. It will be uncomfortable for some of the people in those agencies who are very comfortable and motivated and interested to do the specific work that they're doing from from the location that they're doing it from. I don't think it's efficient. I don't think it works for the big picture for the state the way we've been doing it in the past. There is a natural progression that this consolidation follows, and I think it's worthwhile simply because it's better than the alternative, not without its challenges. Obviously, the folks in the new, if we can get to that point, the new agency or the consolidated portion of ANI, if we don't go to a new agency, are going to shoulder an enormous responsibility for being responsive to the needs of the agencies. If there is a perception that, you know, you can't raise anybody over the phone, something breaks, you can't get it fixed, what I've heard many times from agencies is, gee whiz, do I get in line if I've got a problem? And what if my problem is particularly critical? All of this relies on the leadership and judgment of the folks that are in charge and the folks that are assessing problems, the responses to problems such as this. I have an enormous amount of confidence in Mr. Waters. 20 years from now, or 10 or 5 or whatever, Mr. Waters joins the Foreign Legion, we may have issues. But in terms of having somebody at the lead of this effort that is strategic, that is strong, that is creative, and who is darn smart and not darn up to date on what's going on in this realm, I just have great confidence in where that goes. No guarantees, Mr. Chairman, but I do think it's the right way to go. And again, if it happens in a vacuum, there are going to be problems. But Flint has gone to great pains to try to incorporate agencies through a couple of councils that are out there. I think, as always, certain agencies chose to ignore those councils for a while. And it's kind of like not doing your homework and showing up in class and the person sitting next to you has done the homework. They're far more able to participate in what's going on. So those agencies that sort of ignored this for a while are playing catch up. But I do think it is worth the trouble. I don't think it's risky necessarily, so I won't say it's worth the risk. But it does have inherent potential conflicts that all of us are going to have to address.
We began to look at the structure. A couple concerns I think we all have. And first of all, I mean, if we talk about creating a separate IT centralized entity. I'm reminded of the exercise that we went through with Workforce Services, where we split. We've got Workforce Services, we've got Department of Employment, and then we find out that in the end that they weren't a separate entity. Most people looking for their centralized IT or centralized services for employment related, so we recombined them. And so going back to taking with that sort of thought in mind when we look at the structure, I mean, is IT really a separate area that deserves its own agency, or is it part of A&I and we need to make sure that we structure it in a way that it's strong?
Mr. Chairman, I think you could do it either way. I think it's rational to have it as a separate agency. Right now, the statutes are in conflict, if you will, and we need to clear up those statutes. I think it's effectively, Mr. Chairman, what you get through the creation of a separate agency is not a whole lot different from what exists now, and you're not going to wind up with a whole bunch of HR folks. You're not going to wind up with a bunch of new accounting folks. You're not going to wind up changing a bunch of signs all over the place. I think it's reasonable to do to create a separate agency. What we're really talking about here, Mr. Chairman, is attempting to foster problem solving, strategic problem solving. And in my mind, having a bunch of really smart people working together to solve problems and moving on to the next problem and moving on to the next problem is a good solution, or at least potential to be a good solution, rather than having a couple of people in each agency scattered all over the place trying to address things. Well, in the meanwhile, we have this sort of crazy mushrooming of master service agreements that sort of occur without that I'm getting a little theatrical, but without adult supervision to some degree, I think there is a need to place some degree of authority within the OCIO. The OCI's office and within ITD. Agencies will struggle with it to some degree. That, you know, originally they weren't happy about having to run their IT purchases through ANI, and I think most people have gotten through that. There are bugs to be worked out with that. You'll see that in the budgets. But generally that's going to work well, and I think the expectation is that I can't say it necessarily saves money, although in this case I think it does, but it certainly stems the increases. There are efficiencies that can be accomplished here, and I recognize what you suggested, Mr. Chairman. You go back to the days of the debate over the creation of Workforce Services. Heck, we all remember Dick Sadler back then saying this is absolutely not necessary to carve pieces of various agencies out and create the Department of Workforce Services. I think in hindsight, he was right. So I recognize the potential conflict there, Mr. Chairman. But and the history of divisions and establishment of agencies and such, whether this has the title of agency or not is not something that I'm losing sleep over, Mr. Chairman. But I think the centralization of this authority is absolutely worthwhile.
That comes back to we all have confidence in Flint, and we're hearing nothing but compliments from agencies. That's great. But as we again, you know, we don't have to look back far in our recollections to think of IT services that weren't getting provided. And so as we create the model, I guess the model is what's likely to perpetuate an organization that provides the highest level services. I know in my office now, when the internet goes down and computers go down, we start cleaning the office. You just can't. There's really not a lot you can do without being able to type, print, and get on the internet. It's just an incredible thing to me to see that you can go read a book, but now our electronic research is online. Everything is online. I think our agencies are the same way. When their IT services are down, they're dead in the water. And I think in terms of the model of A&I, I mean, having served in the state government, if you go there and you can't get a vehicle or you get a rotten vehicle, most people, they can go out and get in their own car and grouse about it and go on and get their work done. But IT services are not that way. So I don't know how to I kind of sense maybe that where you're thinking about the same things and you're tending to go towards an independent agency, maybe in part because it forces the head of the IT services to be at a cabinet level and see eye to eye with the directors, and so the directors can call them and say, look, you're not performing. Is that a fair assessment of where you're going? I'm not sure.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's an absolutely fair assessment. In my mind, the OCIO, or whatever we title, and I can't remember what the legislation describes it as, but I'll assume that it mentions the title as the director of this new division, needs to be eye-to-eye with agency directors, in my mind. That has, I believe, not been the case as the position of Chief Information Officer for the state of Wyoming has matured. If you go back a few years to when I first joined the executive branch, I believe the OCIO, and actually up until a year ago, it was a contract position, wasn't a state employee. The level of expertise, this is no knock on anybody, but over the 9 years that I've been involved with this, the level of expertise in the position has advanced significantly with each step. This is a maturing process, and I recognize your comments about the importance of the internet. I got a lot of filing done yesterday, Mr. Chairman. I don't know how many members of this committee are aware. There were very significant internet-related issues right here yesterday for quite a number of hours, and. These are my notes, so it was no problem for me to worry about how I was going to do my presentation this morning because they're right here in good old crayon. As I was thinking, how difficult that yesterday's events might make things for the discussion of a new or a separate agency or a very strong OCIO position. I'd note, and I don't know whether Flint would want me talking about this or not, but what caused this was an agency, forgive the terminology, going off the reservation, doing something on its own, which broke everything else, or at least big pieces of everything else. And I believe there are ways to avoid that. The agency independence, if you will, each agency having significant independence over IT, is nice in theory. It runs into problems, and yesterday is an example of that. I think the argument would be, and who knows, maybe people would argue it, but that if agencies were doing what is expected of them, which is to coordinate with ITD and the CIO's office before they do something significant like yesterday, yesterday's outage could have been avoided. Mr. Chairman, let's go, shall we? I guess in terms of Madam Co-Chair suggested that I do some kind of a summary at the start of this. I think we've gone move well beyond that. A quick notation, Mr. Chairman and Madam Chairman, there are going to be several places through this budget where I need to point out errors to you. They're typically errors not so much in decision-making, but the way it is depicted in the budget document. The first of that, Mr. Chairman, is on page 5 in the summary, the agency summary, and I'll refer to this in a few minutes as well. In terms of total employees, You'll note that in column four, if you go all the way down to the bottom where we talk about employee counts, the governor, the exception request out of ANI was to reduce that total number of FTEs by three. Then you go over to column six. Again, we're on page five. The governor actually has recommended a reduction of one more position. That's not reflected there. The governor's recommendation in terms of FTEs in the Department of ANI is therefore 246. If you were to go into column seven, that's for full-time employees, and the total authorized employees, 248. In the interest of time, Mr. Chairman, I'll just jump in and let's head into the division by division work, if that's okay with the committee. And Mr. Chairman, I guess I'll, again, in the interest of time, I'm going to focus on exception requests. Happy to visit to answer questions or address in greater detail anything that I can at your request.
I think that'd be great. When we get to the internal service funds, I do want to spend a little bit of time, make sure that all the new members understand how the ISI, how they work, how the assessments are made, and we'll talk a little bit about how we assure ourselves that the use of those reserve accounts are being productive, because there are huge amounts going out and spent. So we'll talk about that when we get there.
Absolutely. And Mr. Chairman, certainly on that question, and if we were to spend too much time on things like how cost allocations are arrived at, I'm going to need plenty of help in explaining that for you folks, believe me. All you need to do is see my math SAT scores to know it's best to have somebody else explaining that stuff, Mr. Chairman. I'll mention once that we'll go to page, when we go to the director's office, page 12, what you're going to see there, as you have seen throughout agency budgets that you've been looking at, first of all, in the standard budget, you'll note the governor's recommendation on the OCIO's funding, what I call very informally the funding swap. So if it's the will of the committee, I'm not going to address that. You'll see that all the way through this agency. Similarly, Mr. Chairman, the first exception request on page 13 having to do with computer replacements, Flint certainly will be able to talk about this afternoon. You've already heard about it in December, and more than likely you've heard from agencies that it's essentially a menu of prices that we're working from. The budget office, the governor's office, the CIO have all arrived at a menu of prices of equipment, if you will. And so here and all the way through the ANI budget, you'll see adjusted numbers for the exception request for what used to be called and probably still is called the routine replacement of computers.
Interestingly, Stephen over the judiciary, and he was proud to say that not all your prices are low, that they've got some lower prices, so I'll be interested in talking about that.
Mr. Chairman, as this process has moved on, I get the feeling that IT purchases fall into the realm of auto purchases, and you can get a lot of people convincing you that we got the best deal right here.
Well, let's actually, that's... When we start getting into internal service funds and using them to replace product, and you're creating reserve accounts so that when you will see this in vehicles, so you see an enormous amount of money being purchased through the depreciation reserve accounts that we've created. And so here we are going through these budgets looking at $1,000 at a time. Then we'll go to your budget and we'll drop $250,000. In one budget, and we don't have any scrutiny. We have no, and we want to have a little bit of discussion on that. But the largest amount of purchases that we would have are embedded in your budget, in the CIO's budget, and we just assume that we're getting buying power. We assume we're getting great prices, and yet we see all this nickel and dime stuff, and it really is. You see it. Every exception request is like, I need a computer for $3,000. And then all of a sudden, we hit this budget, and this is where the real purchases are. And we just need to recognize that and have that discussion.
Mr. Chairman, I always hesitate to say that I'm not sure I agree, but I'm not sure that you see a bunch of computer purchases that are spread across agencies reflected here. Vehicles, yes, but not so much computer purchases.
Well, but that will become the case if we adopt the recommendations.
We head in that direction, yes, Mr.
Yeah.
Chairman.
Which is okay. I see what you're saying, though. I mean, but the ISI firms for IT, right, the internal service account dollars mostly just for Internet common services.
Yes, with and again, primarily what we're talking about is Agency 306 rather than 6 as we build this. And I've already ventured into areas where it's best to have Flynn answer questions like that, but never stop me from offering an opinion, Mr. Chairman. That's it in terms of exception requests in the director's office, I believe, that we go next to. By the way, Mr. Chairman, I've asked all of the administrators to throw something at me when I venture too far into wrong land or weird land as we go forward here. We move on to the professional licensing boards, Mr. Chairman. First exception is on page 20. Again, this has to do with computer replacements. Mr. Chairman, as many of you are aware, for the ANI-supported boards, there is a staff of ANI employees who serve these, 18 boards reflected at Agency 6A. These are the folks that do the support work for the licensing boards. I'd note an error on page 20 in the governor's recommendation. You'll see that in that first line, I recommend approval of $5,771 in general funds as one-time funding. That, in fact, should read special revenue. Brett assures me that he will be working with all the appropriate folks as we run into these sorts of what I would describe as drafting errors, but which are significant nevertheless and need to be cleared up, that will be taken care of as we go forward. But I wanted to bring that to your attention. Mr. Chairman, that is the only exception request for the professional licensing boards. If there are no questions, Mr. Chairman, I'll move on to the ever troublesome budget division. Mr. Chairman, there on page 26 and 27, you see the standard budget, the routine exception, what I'll take the liberty of describing as the routine exception for computer replacements. There is no other change from the standard. In other words, no additional exceptions in the budget office.
With respect to the computer, I assume now we've fully transitioned through the agencies that have leases that were getting regular replacement of computers because they had leases for their computers and they were automatically embedded in the ANI's service budgets, and so they were getting replacements without review. Is that all now behind us, or are there agencies still out there with service agreements who have budgets for those service agreements so we don't see the replacements?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know how to answer that. My understanding,
do you know the answer to that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we have, in the context of this budget, found at least one additional instance where that authority needed to be altered in the context of the budget, and that would be Department of Family Services. But when we get to that agency budget, you'll see a reflection where that leasing money is being drawn out of the standard budget, and in fact they are being converted over to computer purchase. I'm not exactly sure how those transitions have worked over time, but this would appear to me to be one of the last of those.
All right. And we have the budget footnote that essentially tries to capture those. I assume that we probably ought to continue that budget footnote for at least one more biennium to make sure we've captured it. And then I guess the next question is the budget footnote that we have that says all service agreements purchases have to go through the OCIO. is it broad enough to capture everything, or do we need to broaden that language?
Mr. Chairman, I apologize, but I'm not familiar with that language, so I'm not sure. I can't answer that question.
Oh, it might focus on. Well, I see Bill picked up the budget to look at it, see if he could find it. But generally, what we were trying to do is, for those folks that don't have a recollection because they weren't there, we had a number of agencies that were leasing products, and then just like your real estate lease gets. If you go out and lease space for employees, then that becomes part of your standard budget, and it just gets rolled over, so it's easy to pick up lease space and just hold it. The same thing was happening with an equipment. They would go get an equipment lease. The equipment lease would then get thrown into the standard budget, and if they were on a two-year, three-year replacement, then we didn't see them. All we saw was... Mm-hmm. It is embedded in their standard budget, so we're trying to pry those out of the standard budget and say, with respect to equipment, our preferences, we know that in service agreements there's an embedded interest rate, and we're essentially paying an interest rate and a service fee, and we were trying to pry those out and said, let's go to purchasing and more control. Bill, did you find the language?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, there's both those Section 317, Section 318 in the 2010 session laws budget bill. And that's pretty extensive stuff there.
We'll see those sections when they come out, and then Brett and Bill and Flint, all three need to review those footnotes to make sure they're comprehensive enough to accomplish a capture of these things so that we can make sure we're getting a further hold of it.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize, too. My understanding of the little bit that I heard at the beginning of this conversation, I'm assuming you're talking just about the leasing component of this?
We're talking about everything. I mean, in terms of just trying to get a hold of our IT acquisitions. I mean, are we going to have four-year turnover, five-year turnover? I mean, as we consolidate, we're going to get a more uniform issue or addressing of it.
And also, Mr. Co-Chairman, we've had presentations to this point where agencies are 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. Some are until they die. So that's another, I'm not sure we need a structure of how to do that, but I mean, I like that idea too, that we had one agency say all we need it for is to, you know, to type on it, and that's all they're mm-hmm. using it for.
Mr. Chairman, I believe Mr. Waters is it addressing that, will address it, the notion of 2, 3, 4, 5 years. He has that in his sights. Part of that involves, you know, and here we go. I get a little off into areas that I may not have great expertise in. But there's been the suggestion that once a computer runs out of warranty, well, holy moly, we'd better trade it in and do something else. Well, in fact, we have Flint has folks on his staff that are certified by whatever organization does that, to work on specific brand name equipment. Again, I shouldn't go too far on this, but he's got that in his sights, and I think he's got a pretty good solution to it going forward. As I sit and listen to the budgets that you're dealing with and have gone through the budget hearings as well, I shake my head at, you know, two-year turnaround, three-year, four or five, and obviously, there needs to be it's another example in my mind of some value in having a central agency overseeing this stuff, while at the same time being responsive to agencies that say we have different requirements for our equipment, and I think he recognizes that.
Along that line, what I'm not fully understand is, if we, let's suppose we we end up setting up a new CIO's office, a director level position, then you say, okay, you're responsible for making the decisions on equipment acquisitions, doing all these services, things like that. Is there still a component of the services that they would have be involved with that really belong in A&I? I mean, I assume that you folks have the budgeting capacity to do the internal service funds, to do the accounting, the budget, the things that we see. Does that still reside with A&I, or does that carry over to the CIO?
Mr. Chairman, elements of what you just described would remain in A&I. There'd be a memorandum of understanding or something along those lines for accounting, human resources, and things like that. There would continue to be the interaction between the two, and some would still remain housed in A&I.
Have some centralized human resources component within your division and not a second IT budgetary staff.
Correct, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I believe that's it for the budget division. Where is Mr. Cathcart? We may have him up here. Oh, he's hiding in the corner. Okay, I'm not sure that we'll need him for this initial conversation on general services, but we'll go, Mr. Chairman, to page 30, general services procurement. Again, you have the standard, what I'll call OCIO switch on page 30. The only exception in procurement is computer replacement, $6,344, again on pages 30 and 31. Moving on to surplus property, Mr. Chairman, on page 34. There is no exception request. Again, governor's recommendation on the OCIO funding switch is found on page 34. Mr. Chairman, continuing in general services, a very significant component of this budget is next, risk management. Mr. Chairman, the governor has, as you'll see, the standard budget for risk management includes a very significant general fund appropriation identified, I believe you'll find it on page 37. You'll see it in the list of revenue sources for the risk management section. $10.228 million, the standard budget general fund appropriation. I must tell you that, and I always hesitate to compliment legislators, Mr. Chairman, but the reason we opened this up was because I just could not figure out how we could achieve 8% cuts when we're looking at this $10 million appropriation. You know, I was kind of going unit by unit. We'll drop a position here, drop a position there. And here you are with $10 million in general fund appropriation. And the basic answer is we don't need this large of a general fund appropriation in the standard budget. I probably should have found that on my own through the budget development process, but I'm grateful to the folks that do this work in the agency that found it as a result of the 2, 5, and 8 discussion. Mr. Chairman, the self-insurance fund maintains a reasonable balance. Risk management has the most recent actuarial, I guess I'll call it review or report of risk management, suggested, I'm not terribly familiar with actuarial reports, but generally they tend to offer low risk, medium risk, and shall we say high risk projections in terms of how much money should be available to cover potential payouts out of risk management situations. And I, frankly, we just had too much doggone money in the general fund appropriation. Mr. Chairman, on page 37. You see the governor's recommendation to reduce the standard budget. This is a proposed $4 million reduction in the standard budget, general fund standard budget, to be made up in part by a reflection of $1.5 million, authorization of $1.5 million in interest income off of the self-insurance fund. The self-insurance fund carries over, obviously, from year to year. It grows both through general fund appropriations or other appropriations which do not require expenditure, but also it grows as a result of interest earnings. To be brief again, Mr. Chairman, the governor has proposed dropping that standard budget by $4 million general fund and then increasing the internal funds by $1.5 million, right, reflecting the interest.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could I have a definition of reasonable balance? I think that's the term used to say where that fund was sitting at.
Mr. Chairman, that would reflect my SAT score. That's my terminology, Mr. Chairman. I'm sure that, and perhaps Joyce has the terminology, I don't know, but in any case, that's where the actuaries, to some degree, wanted us to be, is to a level approximating $40 million.
$40 million?
Yes.
$40 million. You know, in the past, we've gotten actually from Joyce or somebody a summary of what the balance of the account is, what the payouts over the last year were. And, in fact, we got a little bit of a breakdown of the kind of things that are being paid so people would understand what you're now talking about is your a combination of your you've got separately fire and casualty. This would be really your governmental tort claims liabilities that we're paying for our snow plow drivers, things like that, when unfortunate things happen. So if we could get that sort of summary of, pardon me.
Mr. Chairman, is that a separate fund then? You're saying there's two self-insurance funds?
Let's just go into it. I think we have, on the fire and casualty, for example, if something happens here, we have insurance and reinsurance. We have a level of self-insurance, reinsurance, and on. We might as well just talk about that. Are you're not. I can tell by your face. Who's the best person to talk about that? Maybe you are, Chris. Go ahead.
I think we're going to have a little trouble coming up with the breakdown. Reinsurance or additional insurance?
Well, I think we got a couple things happening. You got your governmental tort claims. We actually insure ourselves against that because it's capped. We know exactly what it is. And the Judiciary Committee this year is looking at making adjustments to the Tort Claims Act. So I assume that when you folks see that bill, and when we see it, we'll get a fiscal note, and this is the account that will be affected by the change in, if we raise, for example, limits from $1 million to $2 million or whatever. Right now it's $250,000 per incident, and I think there's a proposal to raise that governmental tort claim amount. It not only affects this section because we'll have to accrue more resources for it, but local governments then pay into it to pay for their amounts, so the local governments, their budgets will be affected too. Then separately, in risk management, we have millions of dollars of assets out here, and we pay for insurance, and I think we have some self-insurance, and that's what I was trying to forget. We'll get to that section. I think it's a different section where we pay our insurance premiums. I hope we have insurance.
We do. We sure do, Mr. Chairman.
Lots of it.
It's a fairly routine element, not just in terms of whether the building falls down, but throughout things like state parks, it is not at all uncommon for risk management to contract for additional insurance as well. And I think you see that in various elements of state government.
Where do we see the premiums for those insurances? Is it in this account?
I think it would be, yes, Mr. Chairman.
So when we look at that's one where you look at the insurance bond premiums, that's the 0254. So we're paying about $7 million a year of insurance for all of our assets. Is that about right?
Hang on. Mr. Chairman, I think it rather than doing Watergate hearings with my counsel whispering into my ear, why don't we just have Rory answer that, please?
All right.
Mr. Chairman, Object Code 0254 does include the payments for premiums. It also includes our settlements as far as the budget is concerned. So we're not paying $7 million in premiums. We also have budgeted for any settlements that may occur over the biennium.
In general, what when you look at the value of our insured assets, what are does that be mostly buildings? And what kind of what are our assets insured for?
Mr. Chairman, I can't answer that question.
You might give that to us. I mean, it's just an interesting note. It's a way of knowing. What it is that we have out there for inventory, and then, of course, the University of Wyoming has close to $1 billion worth of assets. But are you being insured everything from the state capitol building to the facilities in Evanston? All the state facilities all have a value, so it's an interesting thing to know. It also ties into your major maintenance. What are you paying? How are you maintaining? And it's just a good thing to know. Senator Von Vleteren.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the $7.5 million that we have budgeted for the biennium, Ms. Horsley, would there be a balance that would come out of that every year? Or we would, I mean, premiums, you know you're going to pay it. This is what your premium is for the year. But on that, where we're doing premiums and settlements, would there be a balance that reverts at some point after the biennium? Or is there a fund that's being built up with the balance?
Mr. Chairman, the way that this self-insurance fund works by statute is that any appropriation that goes into the fund does not revert. So everything that's appropriated by the legislature, including the general fund appropriation, transfers into the self-insurance fund 6, and it carries forward.
Was that the $40 million, give or take?
That's
okay,
correct.
Thank you.
Now, following up on that, when I first read this, I thought that the 1,500 or the 1.5 million was of internal funds were essentially being charged out to agencies. You're not. It's actually interest income.
Correct, Mr. Chairman.
Wouldn't the interest income already have been embedded in the actuaries' assessments? Because we've always had, or is this interest income that was previously going to the general fund and now we're redirecting it?
Mr. Chairman, I'll stand to be corrected. My recollection of the discussion of this is spending authority for the interest income, where I do not believe it reflects a change of flow to the general fund.
I just would have assumed that if whatever interest is now being made was always being made, and probably before it was adding to the $40 million balance, and so you're not creating new revenue sources. So when you say, okay, I mean, ultimately you are reducing the flow of revenue into that account by $4 million, no matter how you look at it, because it was already receiving the $1.5 million in interest.
Correct, Mr. Chairman.
So then we're back to the premise then, and that is, I mean, I remember when there were times where this fund was underfunded and it wasn't very much fun to pick up the liability that all at once, and so I don't remember jumping up to, you know, I don't remember where the $10 million came in, but I remember a resolution that we'll never do this again because it's too painful to pick up deficits. So I guess what I'm looking for is assurances that if we drop it from $10 million to $6 million, that's going to cover all of our losses and we won't be saying, hey, we made a mistake.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there is always the opportunity for additional authority to use through the B11 process, I believe, to use some of that self-insurance fund if necessary during the course of the biennium. Mr. Chairman, my belief is that the reduction of $4 million still leaves, to some degree, a cushion. In fact, arguably, it could have gone even lower. And in our review, it's a little difficult when you're dealing with the highway patrolmen that are abducting Walmart truck drivers to know what settlements are going to be in situations like this. So you rely on the actuarial review, if you will, of these sorts of things, and using that review as a basis, my answer to you would be yes. Does that guarantee that we don't need to, in a future biennial appropriation, revisit the standard budget? Potentially, sure.
I had a question. Mr. Chairman, I was curious about historically what have been our payouts or our settlements.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have that with me. I don't know whether Joyce does or not. We would be happy to provide that for you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. Just the so if this footnote hadn't been there, where would that $1.5 million of internal funds, how would that have been handled, or does it just slide into that pool somehow? Because it existed, apparently.
And it still does exist. I assume it would have been through B11 to authorize it. Go ahead, Murray. Mr. Chairman, forgive me.
Mr. Chairman, basically the interest earned is going into the account by statute. The account is able to retain its own interest. We just haven't had a need to B11 the spending authority. So this is just swapping out that general fund contribution into that fund with the authority to spend the interest earned.
I thought I understood it, but when you use the word swap, then maybe I don't. Because if what you're saying is that this interest is now going to the general fund and we're swapping it out, that would be a reduction of 1.5 to our profile. This money is actually going in there, and you're just recognizing it where you didn't recognize it before.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I apologize for the probably incorrect term, but yes, the 1.5 interest is—it's always been going into this account.
This special account, yeah. So it's gotten its own interest.
Correct.
So what we're really talking about is that at the contribution level that we were at $10 million. The reserve account, which is approximately $40 million, was growing. And in effect, your actuary is saying you're growing this at a rate you don't really need to grow it, and we'd be comfortable reducing it by $4 million, which will, presumably, the $40 million will still grow because our risk, the longer we live, the more risk we have out there, but it'll either grow or, let me ask you that. If we do this, will the $40 million cushion decline or stay steady or increase afterwards?
Mr. Chairman, it will still increase because each appropriation, if the general fund $6.2 million appropriation is given, then that is still going into the fund. So it will still increase at some level, not as much as it has been if we reduce by the four, obviously, but it will still have an increase as long as there is still the ability to earn interest on that account.
All right. Now, it'll be interesting when we see this bill that's coming through from Judiciary that's looking at revisiting the caps on liability. Agree to this, we just need to make sure that the fiscal note reflects before and after this change. So in other words, it might be that you get a fiscal note based upon the $10 million contribution, and we reduce this by $4 million, and they're saying time out, we didn't properly make an accounting of this.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that the fiscal note would reflect changes that we are discussing here. The fiscal note, as I remember what I saw of it out of risk management, at least the risk management portion of the fiscal note, suggest that it's difficult to tell what the resulting draw on this pool would be, because it, like everything, it depends on who sues who and how things get settled out. There have been, and heck, to add to it, we get into the question of whether, you know, Glendale State Park's going to flood again, and how much of that gets taken up by some elements of risk management reimbursement, if you will, for damages there. It is difficult to pinpoint. What we deal with is primarily history, and then the suggestions from the actuaries.
And I'll admit that the use of the word actuaries causes me to have some great concern, because I've seen actuaries now. We've all seen it on our retirement accounts, saying, "Well, we disagree with that person, that person." What level of comfort do you have that the actuaries have really identified the true risk, and that they're giving you advice that we're not going to be angry at ourselves?
Mr. Chairman, first let me clarify that the actuaries have not weighed in on this specific budget recommendation from the governor. Absolutely not. The actuarial report for risk management is dated, I think, August of 2010. And so I wouldn't want to put them in that situation. How comfortable am I with the actuarial report? I would rather sit in a dentist chair than try to read that thing again. It was not anything that I would claim to have any particular ability to recognize. I went to the bottom line, Mr. Chairman, admittedly, and when they said, here's your top level of exposure, have this much on hand every year. And again, I'm sure they would blanch at the way I'm describing this. That's what I looked for when we looked at this budget.
Well, I guess my concern is that $4 million isn't a huge amount in our total budget, but if we knock out $4 million on a biennial basis, $2 million a year, and then end up accruing a liability that we didn't know about, it'll be harder to take care of later than it is just to continue making the continuous payments. So, I guess we're relying on you, but there's part of me that says, you know, let's have the actuaries revisit it before we make our decision. How easy would it be to have the actuaries say, hey, look, this is our recommendation. Are you okay with it? Are they not employed? Is it Buck that does it?
No, I don't believe so, Mr. Chairman.
Is somebody that's on contract with us that we can call up and say, hey, what do you think?
Mr. Chairman, no, I do not believe they're on contract.
Okay, so that's not that easy.
No, Mr. Chairman.
But it just gives me a great uneasiness to reduce that amount and then not have an actuary promise us that we're going to be okay. But another way to do it is reduce it by $4 million for this biennium, maintain the standard budget until we have an actuary that confirms that the reduction works. I mean, different ways to deal with it, but I appreciate the discussion. Any other questions on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What is your spending authority total? Because this is an increase to the spending authority. Is it the full amount?
It's the spending authority comes out of the Governmental Tort Claims Act, and it's all claims that are authorized to be paid, and you pay it out of the $40 million, right?
I'm not sure if I'm understanding the question. Mr. Chairman, the spending authority is basically what we're looking at here on page 39. If you were to appropriate, you know, say the governor's right column, our spending authority, the $8.5 million is what we would be looking at for the biennium. If we would need to spend any more than that, we would either have to come to you with a supplemental request or process a B-11 to use some of that $40 million that's in that account.
Well, maybe we're talking two different things. I mean, this is the in the $40 million reserve account that you have there? I mean, if you had, for example, a state dam that blew out and you had 10,000 people making claims, they'd be all capped at $250,000 a claim, but the number of claims would be not capped. I mean, it just depends on the risk. Generally, we know that the risk that we have seen is foreseeable because we know that we're going to have a predictable number of unfortunately, let's say, snowplow collisions that are going to create. We cap our liability. We know we're going to have a certain number of claims made by prisoners, but we cap it at 250. Now, the problem there is that if it's a civil rights case, it gets outside of the cap, and we could be paying larger claims for civil rights violation claims that are successful that have no cap. So at any given time, there's a risk that's not capped that we have to pay. But as I would understand it, the real issue is it's both how much are you likely to have to pay. If you saw judgments increasing on civil rights claims, you'd say, wait a minute, we have to put more in. We're not forecasting well on that. So that's an area where you could see increases and they become slow and you wouldn't know it. Another area is where we do things that are different. I mean, if for example, you burn this building down and you have 100 people in it and everybody sues the government, now you've got a bigger risk, something, you have a catastrophic risk. And so I assume somewhere in the actuary's analysis, let's take the retirement account. The actuaries say, well, we were planning for everything except a catastrophic market loss. Of course, you can predict that there's going to be a catastrophic market loss. Now, in this sense, we do operate large facilities that that do have large risk in terms of numbers. And the one that comes to my mind are dams. I mean, we could have a dam failure that could have a huge, wide network of injury. And somebody has to make a decision of what's a reasonable size of a fund. And I have to admit that paying $10 million a year $5 million a year into our insurance account didn't seem like too much to pay. And now we're saying let's cut it back to $4 million, or actually less than that, $3 million a year. And are we just being penny wise and pound foolish? I don't know. I mean, we have to go to you, but I'm a little bit reluctant that you go to a single report. Your level of comfort has been reached by one report, and maybe having the experience of the retirement, maybe it's before we make that decision, we get an actuary analysis of whether or not we should have done that. Because it's not a lot of money until you have the loss. Important for everybody they understand how the account works, what the risk is there, and what we're saving and what we're not. And at that point, everybody can then vote.
You mentioned, Mr. Chairman, that this fund reached a level of uncomfortable. Do you remember when that was, a date?
I don't remember. I remember that there came a time where there wasn't enough money, and we had to increase the. My recollection, it was twofold, and it may not be. I can't remember the times or dates. I apologize. I kind of remember that we had to put more money into it to cover claims, and we increased our annual contributions. Does anybody else have a long-term recollection of that? Maybe it didn't happen.
Mr. Chairman, my recollection of the history of this thing, at least in terms of the budget, was that there would be periodic needs to refill or support the fund. As the chairman described, that became a situation where you had no choice but to bolster the fund to some degree. That puts the legislature in an uncomfortable position where you get an exception request with a you have to do this type of mandate on it. The response was to go to, and this is within the last, I would guess, dozen years. I'm not exactly sure when it happened. to go to a pretty robust standard budget appropriation. And what we wound up with was a circumstance where, in tough times, that appropriation seemed very healthy and very robust, and the fund level was in good shape. So we rely on the actuarial, but no, did they? I didn't get the impression. Actually, there wasn't that level of detail in the actuarial report as to, you know, what kind of catastrophe they are accounting for.
Maybe help make our decisions. Let's go back and look at the last, if we can, 15 years, because that would at least pick up your history and mine.
Mm-hmm.
And because something happened, I just remember something happened. So maybe we look at the contribution levels, what the calls were for extra money, and then we can kind of get a feel for where we have. But I guess you have the similar recollection that there was a call for more money. It said, hey, you don't have any money to pay claims out. And so it was an unplanned event, and then we were trying to plan events. So it's maybe if we look at that history and where the big capital calls were, I mean, occasionally you get a good example is, I hate to bring it up, but the dynamic compaction. You could have things like that create liability out there, and then what happens is the AG is protecting those funds too. And what one of our senators feels like is the AG is protecting that fund too zealously. And part of that is what's the balance of funds. So we are actually setting policy here, and it's just a good thing to know what we're doing. And maybe if we look at a 15-year history, it'll either make the decision easier or harder, one or the other.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to assume that is available, and we'll provide it to you. Yeah, we do have a new. Head of risk management, if you will, Tammy Hooper. I'm very impressed with her. I think she brings a level of expertise that wasn't there in the past. Again, no knock on any predecessors, but I do have great confidence in her.
Steve, and it threw a lot of flags for me, so let's get rid of the flags and figure out what we're doing. get started here. John, when you get, or actually Rosie's back, she's going to be waiting for you. Why don't you look over his shoulder and check his penmanship. I'm constantly reminded that these smart alecky remarks can be sent out over wire. All right. Are you going to initialize that, or do I? You can do that. Would you like me to initialize? I'd be happy to.
I want you to.
All right. Okay, we're good to go. Chris, I apologize for the interruption. Go ahead and continue.
Mr. Chairman, I certainly recognize the importance of the paperwork that you folks were just involved with. Mr. Chairman, the next unit in General Services will be Central Mail. You'll find that beginning on page 41. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to need to expand a little bit on the language in the governor's recommendations, but I'm going to some degree talk about both Central Mail and what you see as the unit identified as Central Mail Postage, which begins on 44. Essentially, Mr. Chairman, again, you have the traditional OCIO switch out, the computer purchases, or replacements, if you will, on page 42. And if you'll allow me a bit of latitude, Mr. Chairman, originally ANI had made an exception budget request for general funds, which were necessary, $81,969. This is on, you'll see it identified on page 45. Equipment rental, to be blunt, there's a mail handling equipment provider that to some degree had us over a bit of a barrel within the last year. Our equipment had run out of warranty. It was desperately in need of replacement, and we were facing some very significant potential charges from the manufacturer in order to maintain that equipment, very specialized mail sorting equipment. I made the decision to go ahead and enter into a new lease for that equipment, which resulted in the general fund request. It was at, and so I know this committee well enough to know that it's a reasonable question for you folks to say, wait a minute, this new equipment is there, and now you're coming to ask us to pay for it. The short answer to some degree is yes. This is indeed leased equipment. The way that I propose to pay for this, Mr. Chairman, is the elimination of a position. I could not do that in the budget because the position I'm eliminating was opened, it was vacated, if you will, through the retirement of an employee. You'll see in the governor's recommendations that that position will be eliminated for a savings of approximately $77,000. It is my intent, and again, we need to clean this up in the governor's recommendation language, that the $77,000 from the elimination of the position would go towards Central Mail Postage for the leased equipment, and the expectation is that within that unit we can come up with a roughly $5,000 difference.
The number for the...
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman?
The number for the employees. Is it in this unit or...
3,007? So, in other words, Mr. Chairman, it should have been reflected in the governor's recommendations on page 42, I believe. And... Well, in the narrative, oh, you're right. Sorry, Mr. Chairman. That's it. Thank you. It should have been reflected in the standard budget.
Hey, Kurt, would you go over and sign your payroll sheet over in the I filled it out for you, but you need to sign it. over in the office. I think they want you now. Yeah. It's apparently become the important thing. Okay.
What kind of pizza, guys?
Everything.
All right. So should we see a reduction? If it's in the 3,007, should it go from 12 to 11?
That's correct, Mr. Okay. Chairman. The governor's recommendation should show that as the reduction of one position, and that's the change that I also mentioned at the top of this that you saw on page 5 or 6. I can't remember which now. Mr. Chairman, if there are no other questions on Central Mail, General Services vehicle replacement, the unit which begins on page 47, a significant exception request in the form of the depreciation reserve funds, $7.961 million in spending authority for the replacement of these vehicles. Both MVMS and agencies participate in essentially a schedule of replacing existing vehicles, which is what these are. I have asked and frankly insisted that MVMS get after agencies who have routinely requested the replacement of large vehicles with more large vehicles. Frankly, I just took the initiative, and if you go down to let's see, it'd be the bottom of page 47 when we talk about the SUVs that are being purchased. Originally, the request for replacements was for 7 small four-wheel drive SUVs, and 2 lines down, 46 mid-size SUVs. I dropped 23 of those mid-size SUVs and made them small SUVs. We're just way too comfortable in state government driving around in big vehicles. I'm not going to try to fix everything all at once, but agencies can run around in little SUVs and it won't kill them. This is not a particularly earth-shaking change, Mr. Chairman, but it is what I intend to attempt to approach through this process, which is to get us a little more fuel efficient.
Is there any discussion about, as we move forward with the new purchases, making sure that they're equipped with natural gas capacity?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the question. The natural gas vehicle conversion process is still a not a particularly seamless one. New vehicles equipped from the factory for natural gas use, if you will, I do not believe exist. They require conversions. Even vehicles that are made specifically to be converted to have the dual capabilities in many cases of both gasoline and natural gas still require a trip to a non-factory conversion contractor. You'll remember that, and that's those that you order from the factory. Mr. Chairman, you'll remember that in the last session, I believe it was $200,000 that was a general fund appropriation to either purchase or convert vehicles to natural gas fueling. That has been slow, but finally we're actually seeing some vehicles on the ground and in the fleet, not very many. This is an expensive process. It is difficult to find contractors that can do this conversion. We now have, finally, an in-state contractor that can do these conversions. They're located, I believe, in Lander. So you run into the adventure of having to haul vehicles up there, do the conversion, and then take them wherever they need to go. It's a very small number of vehicles now that are in the fleet that are have that dual natural gas fuel capability. We're about to receive a couple of vans that are natural gas only. Those will be used, one here by Central Mail, actually, and one here by the Department of Transportation for runs around town. S1, the governor's vehicle, will be converted to natural gas capability sometime in the coming months. This is a process that, in my mind, is still very much in its infancy in terms of large fleet usage, but it is absolutely something we're intending to pursue.
You know, I think there was a time where there were certain maintenance that we farmed out to YDOT that they had, for, like painting, things like that for vehicles, that they had some shop capacity. Has there been any discussion as to whether or not we just develop internally the capacity in our government to do these conversions? And because we may be the biggest customer for these for a long time.
Mr. Chairman, there has been some discussion in the short run, at least in terms of MVMS, motor vehicle service. It was more cost efficient to contract it out than to send our mechanics off for weeks at a time for training for something that it's a little difficult to tell what's going to happen in the future years. We have very few mechanics over there. So, yes, there have been some discussions along those lines, but I'm not sure that we've headed towards the likelihood that the state would assume that principal responsibility.
Is there a fast fill station in Cheyenne?
Mr. Chairman, yes, there is. I saw something in the paper a couple of days ago about a natural gas fueling station getting run into by a car. So if that's that one, I don't know if it works. But there's one here, Mr. Chairman. There's one in Rock Springs. There's one in Evanston. There's one in, I want to say, Riverton, perhaps Pinedale as well. But that's the real challenge over the years, Mr. Chairman, is to... There have been all kinds of proposals about state participation in natural gas vehicle conversions. The question is, where do you fill them up? And should the state in some fashion facilitate the creation of a more robust refueling system, network, if you will, around the state? I don't think we have a solution to that at this point. If I were in the private sector, I might not be very happy having a bunch of natural gas fueling stations at YDOT facilities, which is what we had originally talked about. How do you determine when the state is in competition with the private sector on something like that?
The discussion was, at least on the southern corridor, that the missing area was Rawlins, that it's hard to get from Cheyenne to Rock Springs without stopping in Rawlins. Is there any movement on a private individual building a Rawlins facility?
Mr. Chairman, there's a group that involves industry and state representation that is meeting and that which has the goal of enhancing, if you will, these sorts of the network, if you will. Where specifically they might be going with a Rawlins fueling station, I'm not sure. For what it's worth also, Mr. Chairman, for those vehicles that have dual fuel capability, you just fill up the gas tank and you fill up the natural gas tank, and if you run out of the natural tank, you can still drive on the regular tank. When I looked at the vehicle that was just out back a couple of weeks ago, the sedan that we had converted, It everything looks the same except it looks like there's a sort of half-sized garbage can in the trunk, and that's the natural gas tank. So you wind up with a smaller trunk capability, but you still have the full-sized gasoline tank in the vehicle as well.
On these new vehicles, is there anything that we should be asking for that will aid in the conversion if we choose to go that way?
Not that I'm aware of at this point, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, this isn't on natural gas, so if you don't have anything more, I guess I'll... My question, being a freshman on this committee, is the MVMS depreciation and how that works. It came up because we had a district court judge asking for a permanently assigned vehicle, and I noticed doing the calculations that they're paying $488 a month for a sedan. Do we swap out vehicles every 5 years? And then are these agencies reimbursed back? I'm assuming that you're getting some kind of, you know, value out of the vehicle when you trade it in at 5 years. I mean, at 5 years, there's still value left in the vehicle wherever you're purchasing the new ones. Is that part of the calculation of how all this works?
Mr. Chairman, in brief, yes, it is. There is no specific mileage trigger, for example, that results in a vehicle being traded in. It is an intelligent judgment call. But typically when a vehicle is assigned, the first of all, in terms of operations, which I really shouldn't confuse with depreciation reserve, when you're looking at the charges that an agency is paying for a permanently assigned vehicle, those charges include things like gasoline and maintenance, which are covered by the state. Yes, the essentially folks here will again blanch at the way I describe this, and it's a little informal, but essentially you establish, if you were going to authorize a new vehicle, for example, for an agency, meaning one that had not been provided for in past budgets, that you get the funding authority from wherever it may be to purchase the vehicle. The payments into the depreciation account essentially then allow that agency to effectively trade in the vehicle years down the road for a new vehicle. And it does not involve a new vehicle charge or anything like that. Once the authority for the vehicle in the original appropriation, I'll say that a bit haphazardly, is in the budget, the depreciation reserve is the mechanism by which that vehicle is replaced on a regular basis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Boswell, we've looked at leasing as opposed to buying. Is there cost savings there?
Mr. Chairman, over the years, there have been all kinds of proposals. I can remember a management audit report whenever I was on management audit, sometime in the 1990s, that explored the possibility of leasing at evening. I think there was a bit of examination of the possibility of privatizing the vehicle fleet and the like. Generally speaking, this has been found to be the most cost-effective measure. Now, out there, and this may surprise you, but during your December hearings, I had a lobbyist for a rental car company say, would you think about what would be your opinion of allowing agencies to rent vehicles here rather than signing them out from MBMS? And we're sorry, I'm getting away from the depreciation reserve component of this, but there are all kinds of possibilities in terms of contracts that could be entered into and the like. At this point, I haven't seen anything particularly mature in terms of the possibility of leasing these vehicles.
I mean, you if you lease a vehicle, you say you pay $200 a month. A component of that is the finance charge, which is, say, because whoever you're leasing it from had to buy the vehicle and then lease it to you, they had to pay for it. When you're leasing from us, since we've sort of front-end loaded, we're now front-end loaded, you pay maybe an equivalent amount, but a portion of that fee goes into the depreciation reserve account, which creates the reserve for the replacement. So when you're trying to do the analysis, you have to say, well, at the end of the day, when you lease it, you got nothing. At the end of the day, when you pay your depreciation or your lease payments to A&I, we've taken what would be that interest component, saved it, and that now becomes the source of funds for repurchase or for the purchase of replacement of the vehicle. Is that an accurate assessment?
That is, Mr. Chairman. And also, at the end of this depreciation process, it's not as though the vehicle disappears or whatever. If you were to look at Mr. Cathcart's, the vehicle roster in Mr. Cathcart's shop, you got a bunch of old pickups, a bunch of electricians, carpenters, and the like that are running around Cheyenne in vehicles that are fully depreciated. And it's a good value for the state. Rich doesn't do much in the way of fancy new pickups. His folks are working with equipment that is typically at least 10 years old, or routinely 10 years old is what I would describe it. Mr. Chairman, it's available online. I went back and looked at it sometime before Christmas. I didn't see it as all that illuminating, frankly, but it... And to clarify, Mr. Chairman, it may have been that was specifically talking about game and fish vehicles or something along those lines, but it... Senator Twyford back then was very interested in privatizing MVMS. And so there were discussions back then, and I hope I'm not confusing the two issues with my recollection. Mr. Chairman, the next unit is, in fact, MVMS itself, which begins on page 50. Mr. Chairman, the first governor's recommendation is the funding switch within the standard budget on page 50. The exceptions are two. The first one is on page 51, which has to do with computers. And secondly, Mr. Chairman, the second exception request is on page 52, authorization spending authority for internal funds to reflect the higher cost of gasoline, lube, tires, and such, seeks an increase of $2.37 million. Basically, Mr. Chairman, what happens with the fuel and supplies component of this unit is you make an educated guess at the start of the biennium. Sometimes it works out well. Sometimes it doesn't. We were... if you go back a few years, the educated guess was that the cost would be a little high. They were adjusted down, and then they turned out to be a little low. Right now, what this is built on, in a very basic description, Mr. Chairman, is $4 gas. If what's going to happen to gas prices, I don't know. Again, these are internal funds. If we wind up, I mean, right now we've got high oil prices and low gasoline prices, low in quotes. So it's a little difficult to forecast what occurs over the biennium. The intent here is not to have to adjust rates upward in the middle of the biennium. And so that's why you see that exception request in front of you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, we now move to General Services Administration, page 55. The governor's OCIO swap, it probably really bugs Flint that I describe it that way, but anyway, on page 55, and no exception requests in General Services Administration. Mr. Chairman, next. In General Services, the Rockwell Building Maintenance, which begins on page 58. Mr. Chairman, the standard budget, you'll note that it now reflects the full biennial cost of maintenance of the Rockwell Building. There is an exception request relative to the OCIO switch, but again, the building maintenance cost for Rockwell reflected there.
Mr. Boswell, it seems like that is a little high on square footage, but am I understanding that this is the custodial and maintenance complete for the building and the grounds, I assume, at around $8 a square foot? It just seems a little high. I noticed a couple more pages will go into the Capitol complex, and with all the employees and everything, it seems like it's only $2 a square foot. So... just questions as they go out for quotes. I assume it's a contract with a private entity, no employees involved. How did that come about, I guess, would be my question.
Mr. Chairman, I might ask either Rory or Mr. Cathcart to go into the details.
Up. I was going to add, and while you're coming up, Rich, the issue with the Rockwell building, as I understood it, is that we got an extraordinary opportunity to buy the building at a reduced price. Once we acquired the building, we realized that it had a very high maintenance cost, and it was a very nice building. And there was discussion last year about, well, should we sell it? And there were buyers for it, and I think that the notion was, as well, wait a minute, what is the cost to replace the building? Because it makes no sense to sell it, even if we get more money, and spend the same amount to replace it with another building. And so my question is, what's the status of all that? What's the current thought with respect to whether it's appropriate building to be in our inventory? And how are things working out generally? As I understood, it was going to be expensive to get it going up. They had the pretty sophisticated control system for their HVAC, things like that. Rich?
Mr. Chairman, on Rich Cathcart, General Services Division Construction Management. Mr. Chairman, this amount reflects an amount as we put the general maintenance of the building out to bid. Because we don't have trades folks and buildings and grounds folks in Sheridan like we do in Cheyenne, we put the general maintenance of that facility out for bid, and there were a number of bidders. This bidder, by the way, was substantially lower than the others. That said, Mr. Chairman, it's still less than we profiled in the spreadsheet for operation and maintenance of that building. So if you take the profile we included in the original spreadsheet when we were considering buying that building, this contract is substantially less than we had profiled for a biennium. I think we had over $200,000 per year profiled in that spreadsheet on costs of maintaining that building. This is a result of a open public bid for the general maintenance of that building.
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Cathcart, is there something really unique about this building? I mean, $8, this is just maintenance, basically maintenance service, so it's not real. It's not operations too, or am I missing something? Operations as in utilities, et cetera? Or is this just maintenance, custodial, repairs, landscape?
This includes all the custodial janitorial work build and the grounds and what you would classify as routine maintenance. Now, that said, if, for example, the boiler goes out and we have a huge mechanical problem, this contractor will not, that's not included in this.
Mike, it's, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. The Rockwell building is quite an architectural piece, and so modern, and it has a lot, three levels. I mean, it's a very complex facility.
Well, building is and is it full?
Mr. Chairman, the building is full. While we have 10 agencies located in Sheridan, we had a total leasing budget up there for 53,000 some square feet. This building is 23,000 square feet. Of course, we weren't able to move all 10 of those agencies into that space. Who is in that building now is Department of Environmental Quality. They were the largest agency in Sheridan, and they nearly filled it. There was some room left, and we moved Department of Health Nursing in that building, and I believe some Attorney General. It is full.
Did we lower our lease cost, or did we increase our lease cost total?
Mr. Chairman, that would reduce our lease cost by a substantial amount. I don't know what that number is right now, but I can get that for you.
I think there was some discussion that if we do retain it, that the site was large enough to do an expansion to pick up their other lease space, and that we could ultimately if you will, dollar cost average some of the higher cost into other space.
Mr. Chairman, that's a possibility. The lot is very large, and there's substantial area, especially in the front, where you could add more facility if desired. Furthermore, you have a full parking garage in the basement, which is kind of like a Sherman tank. You could add office space and pretty good usable space in that parking area.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not advocating for selling the building. I think it's beautiful and it's a great building. It's a great addition up there. I don't think we should need to pull a couple of double wides onto the property to get the rest of the lease space down. But what I would question is, did we save $187,000 a year in other leases? I mean, because of the cost of this, we're paying about that maintenance for this building. Do you know if we save that by moving those other agencies in there?
Mr. Chairman, I'm pretty confident the cost of the maintenance on this building was profiled in the spreadsheet, and I'll get a copy of that. I think Joyce did the original spreadsheet, cost spreadsheet, to determine if it was more cost-effective to buy this building and put state employees in this building or continue to lease. It was more cost-effective over the 40-year life cycle by quite a few million dollars to the state, and at the end of the life cycle, we still had equity in the building. This building is a particularly well-built, very, I hate to use the term, but a very fancy, well-appointed building. Had we built a 23,000-square-foot office building at the time, and we figured it up based on a square-foot cost estimate, and it'd be fairly close. We calculated we were going to be close to $10.2 million to build a building of that size without all the bells and whistles that this building has, because we wouldn't do that for a state office building. That said, we managed to buy this building for less than half that amount.
Mr. Chairman, I would just request, I guess I wasn't here for the initial thoughts on this, but I would just like to see that, what we saved in leases for these three agencies, basically, and what this is going to cost. It's just those two numbers are really all I would need.
Mr. Chairman, it isn't very difficult, and I think Ms. Havnider behind me is the one that does these spreadsheets, and it's a matter of getting the old spreadsheet up and now injecting the actual cost of maintenance, et cetera. And we can come up with a 40-year life cycle and get that back to you.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask one question? Rich, can you tell me, do we own the property where the historic barn is, and are we gifting that or making an exchange there so that would then allow us to have more property to build on?
Mr. Chairman, Madam Co-Chairman, we own that entire lot, and in fact, we own the historic barn. There is a historic preservation group in Sheridan County that would like to move that barn to the fairgrounds so that it could be enjoyed and shown for lots of folks. I believe, and it was on the State Building Commission agenda maybe less than a year ago, that discussion was had. The State Building Commission is fine with gifting that building to the Sheridan County Historical Preservation Group, and they would pay to move it.
Hey, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Cathcart, I've had this question on my mind for a while. When we lease a building, do we pay for the routine maintenance in that building, or is it part of the lease, or does the landlord pick it up, or are all leases different? It just depends on who we're leasing from.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Escobel, we have all sorts of lease arrangements, most of which we lease office space, for example, for X amount per square foot, and it runs anywhere from 15 to some of them are over $22 a square foot. That lease includes the maintenance utilities of the building. So the landlord is responsible for all of those things. In this particular building, now the lease rate is effectively free, but now we have to pay the maintenance and utilities.
Other questions? I think the Rockwell building will be, you know, one of those things that's, it's important to remember how we got in that building, why we're there, and over time it's from a taxpayer's point of view, it's pretty, I haven't seen it. I understand it's an extraordinary building for a state office building, and there's an explanation for it that we have, and it's worthwhile reminding ourselves of it, but it's, you know, I think the message we sent to A&I was, look, if somebody came and wanted to pay the right price so that we could actually build a larger facility for less money and replace it, we'd be willing to do that. But if the sale price would simply replace a building of lower quality with the same square footage, what's the point? I mean, in effect, we got this building at a we got a Sherman tank for the price of a Volkswagen, and it doesn't make sense to sell the Volkswagen or the Sherman tank and then buy a Volkswagen. Any questions? But if that, you know, I think for A&I, if the economics change then such that there's a buyer for it, I mean, if we could sell a 20,000 square foot building and buy a 40,000 square foot building with the same price, we should do it. We should do it if we have that opportunity. But I don't think that I think the opportunity was, hey, you can sell it for more than you paid, but that doesn't mean you could take your proceeds and replace the 20,000 square feet. But at any given time, we could sell a 20,000 square foot palace and build a 40,000 square foot comparable or a suitable state building to house more state employees. We should do that if that opportunity arises. I think that's generally the consensus.
Mr. Chairman, I believe we're now on to facilities operation, operations plural, which begins on page 60. The OCIO calculation there is the included in the governor's standard budget recommendation. Computer replacements are noted on page 61 as exception requests and, exception recommendations. And then page 62, Mr. Chairman, the next exception request is for $51,572 in general funds for new equipment, which would, this is essentially a big, fancy, heavy-duty floor sweeping, cleaning sort of piece of equipment that would be located out at the new liquor warehouse. That we have one of those now, an older model. This would not replace that one. It would be added to the fleet, if you'll pardon the description, essentially we've got a whole bunch of square footage out there, new square footage that we need to take care of, and this is seen as I hesitate to use the term minimum, but it really is an important addition to that. Mr. Chairman, next, custodial services equipment replacement, which begins on page 62, an exception request for a total of $66,437. This is to replace equipment that is routinely at least 15 years old. As you all know, we need to do this through exception budget requests, some snow removal equipment and essentially janitorial floor type equipment, floor care equipment for the Capital Complex. Mr. Chairman, next, page 66, General Services Unit is Trades Management. the governor's standard budget changes relative to the OCIO are on page 66. The first exception request on page 67 for computers. The next exception request is on page 68. This is a $185,521 general fund ask for maintenance contracts for the especially, I think the majority of these costs are relative to the new combined lab facility. We have quite a bit of very sophisticated building infrastructure, which requires or which benefits from maintenance agreements. There is a significant cost to it. We discussed whether or not to continue with maintenance contracts for some of these larger facilities, and the basic suggestion was you open yourself up to a fair amount of risk if you do not have a maintenance agreement for some of this very specialized equipment that is a part of the building's infrastructure. And if we at least there's a potential for a significant downside without these maintenance agreements.
And given the nature of the beast, that we have lots of equipment out there, have we looked at just essentially creating a self-insured account where we put the money in, the equivalent amount, and pay for a maintenance?
No, Mr. Chairman. Not that I'm aware of. It maybe Rich's folks have. I have not heard any discussions along those lines.
It may not be practical because it may be all that, given all of our equipment, all of our lab equipment, everything we have, and the question is, if we put the equivalent amount of the lease payments into an account, some equipment's going to need maintenance, some of them won't, and we become self-insurers of our own maintenance.
I'm not sure how to respond to that, Mr. Chairman, other than to say that I would be happy to start down that road and ask those questions. It is, Mr. Chairman. And again, we weighed whether or not to reduce that, and the downside risk was seen as being pretty significant. Mr. Chairman, the next exception request, beginning on page 68, for at-will employee contract monitor technicians. Over the course of years, Mr. Chairman, these positions have been filled through B-11. Wisely or not, I chose to propose putting this into the budget so that it was a little more transparent. These folks are housed down in Rich Cathcart's shop. They are typically college students or retirees who sit in front of a few screens and make sure that the water in the basement of the Emerson building doesn't come up and things along those lines. They are essentially monitoring alarms and the like in off hours. It was my thinking and that we should just put this in the budget and be upfront about it. And I agree with the governor's recommendation, and of course I agree with all of the governor's recommendations, but I actually suggested this to him that he deny this and that we work with the OCIO. In my fairly naive look at this, I know that the OCIO and the ITD, more accurately, has a bunch of people monitoring a bunch of things on a 24-hour basis, and I struggled with the need to have college students doing homework down in Rich Cathcart's shop. I probably took a little too cavalier a look at this, but it is my hope that we can figure out a way to do this without the need for either B-11s or appropriations. Mr. Chairman, the next unit, General Services Utilities, begins on page 72. There is a you see the standard budget of a little shy of $7.5 million. There is no exception request for that. Mr. Chairman, if there are no questions, next we go to the Construction Management Division, which begins on pages 74 and 75. Again, the fund swap within the standard is located on page 76, an exception request, recommendation, excuse me, for computers located on pages 76 and 77, and there is no other exception request there. Mr. Chairman, the next unit within construction management is on page 80, real property rental. As you know, essentially all leased space that for state agencies are handled through ANI. This is a the description of that, if you will, with a standard budget moving to roughly $25 million. There is an exception request to reduce that amount by $611,000. Frankly, Mr. Chairman, the vacating of the Southside Safeway, the negotiations to move the public defender's office into the Rogers building, which is in process now, happened late enough in the budget process that we couldn't include it in as a standard reduction, so that those savings are reflected through an exception budget request. Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Chairman, question.
I see on page 81 your recommendation approval of the reduction of 610. Then on 82, I see it in total exception request of the reduction of 610. Doesn't that, shouldn't it reflect over in the total governor's? No, I think I answered my own question, Mr. Chairman. Sorry. Got it. It comes out with the same bottom line. Got it.
Mr. Chairman, next we venture into the realm of human resources. If I may, I'll ask Dean Fawcett to come join me because there's quite a bit to talk about in this area of ANI. The first thing I'll preface this with, Mr. Chairman, is to tell you that there has been an enormous amount of progress, an enormous amount of work in human resources over the past 12 months. And I'll get to the specifics as we go along, but page 85 is the governor's OCIO fund swap recommendation within the standard budget. And then we launch into executive branch market and merit increases on pages 85, 86, and beyond. Mr. Chairman, as I think I visited with this committee over the fall, it was my recommendation to Governor Meade that I just go ahead and put in a couple of placeholder amounts for state employee compensation for the budget process, which would be refined through his recommendations. Originally, as you see on pages 85 and 86, I had placed a $16 million placeholder for state employee compensation, and the governor's recommendation appropriately modifies that to a total of $10 million. You'll see in the narrative of the governor's rec on page 86, he has broken that down into two pots, if you will, $5 million for one-time merit payments, $5 million for merit-based market increases to salaries. You can consider that $5 million to be an ongoing appropriation were it to be approved. Mr. Chairman, you'll remember going back a year or so that the governor had recommended an amount in his supplemental budget for market increases and also an amount for one-time merit payments to state employees based on performance appraisal ratings for state employees. We had a vigorous discussion here about the weaknesses of what was then the performance appraisal process in-state government. It was weak. It was routinely ignored by agencies. And I think this committee very appropriately suggested that once an appraisal process or a performance evaluation process could be reworked, re-engineered, put in place, and that might be the appropriate time to seek merit-based compensation adjustments. What you see in front of you, Mr. Chairman, reflects that work. It is not unusual for that to take a significant amount of time. It has been accomplished and put into place. Dean Fawcett, who's the administrator of the Human Resources Division, can go into as many specifics as you might like in terms of how this is rolling out, but for all classified state employees and all at-will state employees, we have the performance evaluation process underway. Those initial discussions between supervisor and employee were all to have taken place before the turn of the new year. That has largely been accomplished. I think our success or the implementation rate is 90% or higher, and you'll remember that in the past we were down in many instances in the 40, 50, and 60% area. Maybe I'll at this point, if you would like, Mr. Chairman, we can talk about the specifics of the performance evaluation process, or we can talk about it from a budget perspective, whatever you might prefer.
It's an important issue that we're going to have to talk about in the total scope of the appropriateness for merit pay adjustments, what's happening in the school systems where we're flatlining districts. We have school districts out there where flatlining. We have the judiciary who the argument being made, the judiciary generally lags behind us because they were looking to see where we were and coming up to us. We need to confirm that that's the case. So as we present the go to the floors, what I'd like to be able to do is say, look, are there employees that were lagging behind because they're always going to catch up? And what I asked the judiciary to do, or we asked the judiciary to do, is say, look, it's not good enough to say we want to go to 91%. The issue is where are state employees? Are we bringing you up to where other state employees are? Then you have the issue of, okay, have we hit the 91%? Are at UW community colleges, do the non-faculty, essentially the non-classified staff, are they about the right area? And are you proposing increases that will move these employees at a higher level than school teachers will be? Or not teachers, but let's say classified folks in the district. So I kind of think we need to know, where's everybody? Are we all at 91? Who's not at 91? Does this bring us to 91? And then when you do the merit pay, does that take you above the 91? And does it only take a small group above 91 as opposed to everybody's? Does that help? We need to have the whole discussion. We need to have an overall recommendation that says, look, teachers are plateaued for a reason. UW either we're going to give them money or not going to give them money for a reason, and in the end everybody's going to be treated equally, the laggers are going to come up, that sort of thing. I kind of want an overall, where are we?
Mr. Chairman, as usual, Dean will blanch as I wander into the description here, but one thing that I think is important to remember is this distinction between one-time payments to employees versus ongoing. And so when you talk about 91%, we're talking about market. We are talking about ongoing appropriations. We're talking about changes to an employee's paycheck every month. That would
we need to understand that. But also it makes a difference if you're giving a one-time merit pay to somebody that's at 89% versus 91. If you got everybody, if you got a guy at 85 and a guy at 91, and the 91 gets it because he's a better employee, if that's what we want to do, that's okay. We just need to understand first, what are we doing? And we can decide what we want to do. I just kind of want to get, and I want to, maybe the way to say it is, I want our bearings straight. At some point, before we go into markup, we need to have our bearings straight with respect to all state employees, all categories, and kind of figuring out where are we moving. Does that help?
Mr. Chairman, perhaps we'll start with a description of what is included in the governor's recommendations for state employees, and then we can venture into the comparison in terms of other possibilities. First, Mr. Chairman, maybe I'll just be smart for once and hand it over to Dean and have him begin this description, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. We did distribute to you a handout. I don't know if you have this letter, but this will be largely what I'm explaining as far as how we're recommending that the market and the merit pay would be distributed to state employees. A couple points I'd like to make is as Director Boswell has pointed out, we do have over 90% of our employees have their performance goals established for them, and the way that the new process works is that those employees will be evaluated again in September, and that's when they'll receive their first overall rating on the new system. What we are recommending is that once employees are rated, we would then consider giving any type of increases to employees in December. So that is a little bit of a change of what we presented to you in the past. Traditionally, we've given employee pay raises in July. This time around, we're recommending that the increases take place in December. So when you look at our numbers, we're proposing calculations based on a 19-month calculation for your review. The other thing that you have to keep in mind is that because the appraisal system is so new, we do not know what to expect as far as the actual ratings of employees at this point. I think that was a concern of the committee the last time we met together, is what would be the rating level distribution among employees in state government and in the agency. At this time, we don't know that, but what we have done is we have built a formula, and we spent a lot of time talking about that formula in September when we met with you, that if we knew what the dollar amount appropriated was, we could figure out from that dollar amount a formula to distribute it to employees. So that's largely what we're proposing and what we would speak about here. On the handout, we have two specific areas that we wanted to discuss with you. One is how the funds would be distributed to the agency, and the second is then how would those funds be distributed to the individual employee. If we were to look first at the merit component, and as Director Boswell said, $5 million, which is a one-time cost, employees would be receiving that increase in December of this year. How we would calculate this is that we would need to figure out how much money we would appropriate to each individual specifically for merit increases. How we would do that is we would figure out what the state's total payroll is on an annual basis, and we would figure out what the agency's general fund percentage of that payroll is. So if an agency has, for example, 20% of the general fund payroll, we would then give that agency 20% of the funds available for merit pay. So it would be an equal distribution based on the funding that's available that's appropriated for this purpose. For those agencies that are funded by other sources or non-general fund, they would be expected to pay for those merit increases out of their own funds themselves, and they would follow the same formula or the criteria that we would prescribe to all state employees. So that is the methodology of how funds would be distributed to the agency. In a sense, each agency will be getting their proportional share of those merit funds. When we move into the specific criteria, then, once we know how much money is available to the agency, what types of awards would be awarded to the employee, we did set up some specific criteria in discussion with the governor. That criteria puts some bumpers on it, if you will, so that one employee in an agency couldn't receive the entire amount appropriated, for example. So what we are implementing is that for merit increases for employees, no employee would be able to receive more than a $2,000 maximum one-time merit pay bonus. That would be for a superior rating. That's the highest rating level on our rating scale. If you'll recall, our previous appraisal system had a 3-point rating scale. We've now graduated to a 5-point rating scale. So it's a larger rating scale, more robust, if you will. But this would be the highest level of superior employee in any agency. The maximum amount would be $2,000.
Now, Dean, when you're starting, you take $5 million, I assume there's not enough money to give everybody a $2,000. I mean, what are the number of employees out there that would be in the system eligible?
Theoretically, any employee would be eligible for this increase, but it is dependent on the rating that they receive on their evaluation.
Suppose we live in a world where everybody's above average and everybody hits it. What are the number of employees that actually are out there? I mean, I understand the cap, but are we providing enough funding that there's enough money for if everybody reached 2,000, or is this we're providing a lower amount with a cap?
Senator Nicholas, the answer to that is it's largely controlled by how the agency rates their employees within the agency. So if the agency rated all of their employees hypothetically as superior, there would not be enough money to give everyone 2,000. They would have to reduce that top amount within that agency. So the control factor is built in within the agency on how they rate their employees. And we're also recommending that the second level, which is commendable, would receive a merit increase, which would be approximately two-thirds of what a superior would. The governor recommends that those employees that are competent, which is the mid-level of the appraisal rating, would receive nothing related to merit pay. So it's only the top two levels of employees rated on a 5-point rating scale that would receive an increase.
So if I could, Dean, in theory, what's the actual number of eligible employees in state government for the $5 million? Are we talking this? How many active state employees are there?
Every state employee in state government would be eligible for a merit increase.
And what's that number in general terms?
How many state employees do we have?
Yeah.
There's about 10,000 state employees, but we have employees eligible for merit increases about 9,000 state employees.
So, I mean, you've got $5 million. Is it going to be a $2.5 million per year? $5 million for 1 year.
It's $5 million one-time cost that would be awarded in December of 2012.
All right. So that if it's 1 year funding. Now, let's on the market pay. Is that intended to be for 2 years or for 1 year?
Market pay would be ongoing. It would be reoccurring.
But are you intending to use up the entire? I mean, are you going to, if you give a dollar out in the beginning of the year, are you going to charge yourself for $2 because it's going to cost you $2 for 2 years? But if you give it the money at the end of the year, you got $1, but it's going to come back at $3 obligation. You just follow me?
Mr. Chairman, the intent is for the full 19 months of the remainder of the biennium beginning on December, in the December paycheck of 2012.
Okay. Well, the market, if we look in terms of the market pay, that may create, I mean, if you go in and you bring everybody up by $5 million under the current, at the beginning of the biennium, then it will cost us $5 million next year. To the extent that you use money at the second year of the biennium, it'll cost us more.
Correct, Mr. Chairman. And just to be absolutely clear, with the 19-month figure, if you were to carry that forward, I suppose you'd have to calculate a 24-month period for the ongoing biennial cost of that.
Okay. And then so if you're looking at So if you got $5 million
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
Doesn't that second $5 million become part of the standard budget, but it has to be prorated up by 6 months more? So it'd be $5 million plus 25%.
Depends on when you gave it.
They're talking about December, Mr. Chairman. So it'd be 6 months additional.
Well, the market pay doesn't apply there. Market pay might happen, Nick, tomorrow.
No.
We're recommending that both market and merit increases would be awarded in December of 2012.
So there'd be no position for market adjustments for employees that were not aligned correctly. So they could go up in positions. They could change positions, but there'd be no market adjustment. All that market adjustment money is now gone until that same day.
Mr. Chairman, I think that would need to occur within agency budgets, within existing budgets.
Okay. Fair enough. All right. So, I mean, if everybody hit it, you're talking about $555 about for every employee if everybody hit average. So, in a sense, the built-in of the system is if you know you've got extraordinary employees that you want to reach to 2,000, you're going to have an equal number of employees that are not getting there. So in some sense, the system, the more people you want to get to 2,000, the more people you have to have at zero. So this, I'm not saying that that's what you think about, but the system sort of is self-monitoring because it assumes that to implement, it's going to cost you $500 employee, essentially. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, the intent is to give specific funding to the agency without dictating them to them, if you will, how their performance ratings would be distributed to the employees within the agency. So they're accountable for their own ratings.
Yeah, for sure, but they're capped. I mean, if you gave everybody, said, okay, if everybody was above average, you'd have to, and you needed 2,000 apiece, they don't have the 2,000.
Right.
So if their resources are, say, $500 per employee, then that's going to create an internal motivation to make sure the system doesn't breach the $500 because you're limited by your resources.
And the second component of that, Mr. Chairman, is that it prevents one agency from skewing the statewide. If we were to give everybody if we were to calculate it on a statewide percentage and one agency was to skew the ratings, it would reduce the dollar amount for all other employees in other agencies. This limits it to within that specific agency.
If you're an agency where the average salary is, if you have all engineering staff and you're at 70,000, their bonuses go up to 2,000. And if you're an agency that employs mostly janitorial staff and their average salary is at 25,000, 30,000, they get the same bonuses.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
So it's not as the bonus, except that you're allocating to them a percentage of total payroll, so that the higher your payroll is, the more money you get to work with.
And that would in turn reflect the salaries of the employees in that agency.
But the, going back to that motivation, if the $2,000 is the cap, let's take the AG's office. You're hiring all lawyers, and they're all being paid $80,000. The maximum you can get is $2,000, and if you're employing all people, and another agency employs all people that have $25,000, $30,000 salaries, they could get the same bonus.
That is correct.
Okay. Gotcha.
That is the criteria for the merit component. If I could then switch to the market component, which follows a similar concept for distribution in the sense that A&I will be working to calculate where the employees are in relationship to the current market. And if you'll recall, last year when we moved employees to 91% of the market, MPP that we call it, we moved approximately 46,000 employees, got an increase last year, 4,600 employees got an increase last year, moving them to 91% of MPP. The important takeaway here is for you to know that approximately 62% of Allstate employees are currently below MPP. So we did move a significant number of employees last year, but we still have 62% of our state employees that are not at the market policy position.
Dean, let me make sure I understand what it is. We're hitting the target of 91%.
Correct.
Is the 62%, is that the number of employees that are below the 91% of MPP, or is that below MPP?
It's below MPP. So,
all right. How many, what's the percentage of people below 91% of MPP?
Those would only be the some agencies that have hired employees since the last pay increase or moving people to 91% in July. We're less than a couple hundred people where agencies have hired them below 91%.
It's your belief that as we sit here today, except for the anomalies that are few, everybody's at 91% of MPP?
That is correct.
How many people are above 91% MPP for a variety of different reasons?
We have approximately 6,000 employees that are between 91% and MPP. 4,600 employees were moved to MPP last year, so that's a little over 2,000 employees are above 91% of MPP and up to MPP.
I've written this down. I want to make sure I've got it. So you've got about 6,000 employees above MPP.
6,000 employees are at MPP or below. Approximately 4,200 employees are at 91% of MPP. And the remaining balance is the number of employees that is between 91% and 100% of market.
All right. So I wanted to learn more about the people that are, if our target was 91%, that's what I thought, or was our target MPP?
Correct.
Which is it?
91%, Mr. Chairman, was the minimum that we were shooting for. The market policy position is the 100% level.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I still don't have it quite straight, so we had we moved up 4,200 employees to 91% of MPP. Last July. And then we had, did you use the number 6,200 are still below the 100, but they're presumably above the 91. And so if you're working with 9,000 presumed employees, then the number's 20. Then you would have 2,700 who would be above, or 2,800 rather, who'd be above MPP. Is that correct?
Yes. Approximately.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman, I'm.
I don't know that I've got the numbers yet. Let's do it this way. Have we got it?
Yeah.
That didn't tell us the numbers.
The list.
Yeah. I mean, let's. What I want to do, Dean, is have you give me the numbers for the numbers or percentages at 91%, 91 to say 95%, and then 100%, and then above 100%. Can you give me those categories?
We can, Mr. Chairman. We just have to find it. That's a very available.
Let's do that during launch, okay?
Okay.
So can you do that during launch,
yes,
Chairman?
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Just a quick question on the handout that we received, individual award criteria. You testified just a minute that superior and commendable, it was two-thirds for the commendable. In your handout here, it says three-fourths.
I am corrected. It is three-quarters.
It is three. Okay, thank you.
I will get those specific numbers for you at lunch so that you can see that distribution of employees.
So that, I mean, in the abstract, let's just talk abstractly without the numbers. You have a policy of giving, the policy is to get to MPP. You've got people above, you've got people below, you've got people 10% below, let's say. And you're going to use $5 million to work towards MPP. But you're not going to give them that money until December of next year. Can you tell us how many of the people that are below MPP will get to MPP with the $5 million?
Can't no, Mr. Us. Chairman, because these increases or these adjustments to pay are based on their performance, in part on their performance evaluation ratings.
So if... Now, with people that are below MPP, are they there because we did not have the resources to get them to MPP, or there's some other reason that an administrator says, hey, you know, we don't need to pay that guy that much? Or is it both?
Senator Nicholas, it could be a combination of reasons. One would be that when state employees were hired by the agency, they were not hired at MPP. They were hired closer at the minimum of the pay range, for example. The other reason could be that in the last few years we have moved to a new compensation plan, so people who were once at MPP on that compensation plan are now no longer there. So it's a combination of where the agency hired them, where they're at, and what the market policy position is.
And here's the equity problem that I have in my mind. I mean, I think human nature is such that if you really like a guy, you get him in at the highest salary. So let's assume the people that you really like have already come in at MPP or better, and the people that you're not as friendly with maybe working. Let's suppose for this discussion they're working the same hours, same tough. They just different personalities. But they're below MPP. Now you create the merit pay. And the guy that's you like, that's probably working hard, is going to get the 2,000, even though he's at MPP or above. And the guy that's working that you just don't get along well, or you don't, the same chemistry doesn't exist. Maybe he's working just as hard, but he's not even, not only is he below MPP, but he's just not going to get the same percentage. Is that a real concern, or have I just pulled that out? Of course, I pulled it out of thin air, but is it? How do we address the merits of that?
Senator Nicholas, that could be a concern, but the way that we have crafted how market funds would be distributed is that employees would not be eligible to get a market increase above MPP. So no employee would be able to receive a pay raise above the market
But you could get a
one-time
above MPP. That's what I'm worried about, is that the rich, let's call it the folks with chemistry, they get it, and the ones that don't. I mean, you can get higher.
That is correct. With what we're proposing is that there are two types of awards that could be given to employees. One is merit and one is market. It is both sides are dependent on the employee's performance, and there are caps on both as well.
And the answer, I think, Dean, to my concern is that's why we have directors, that's why they're doing it. That's why we have real people making these decisions. Having said that, having worked in state government, I know that oftentimes chemistry makes a big difference. And you can have an employee that does not have chemistry with his director that's working his tail off, maybe longer hours, but he's just never going to get the same rewards. And an employee that the director has a lot of chemistry with, and they work, they're leaving, coming in at 8 and leaving at 5, but in the director's mind's eye, it's the best employee there. And that's just inherent in state government. It's actually in all employment. And so it's an easier system to implement, though, if everybody's at PP, or what we call it?
MPP, Mr. Chairman.
If everybody's at their maximum point, and then you've eliminated a big significant inequity. And the only concern I have, I guess, or one of the biggest concerns is that since not everybody's at that target pay, it gets more complicated. Brian?
Mr. Chairman, the other piece that's come in with the inequities I've spoken to folks was, and I think that our push has been to move to MPP for all of the employees. But one of the pushbacks has been, like, someone, let's say, who's at MPP at 100 or 101, and then what you have is a whole series of people who have been moved up who are working near or them and there, and they've been working just as hard at 100 or 101%, and everybody else has been ratcheted up, and they've viewed inequity in the fact that they haven't received any pieces. The feedback I've gotten on some of this is they've stayed stagnant to catch everybody up to them. But perhaps part of the reason that they were where their MPP above price was based on superior performance, perhaps some sort of transfer or a series of other things that they haven't been adequately compensated for in their minds for the past few years as we tried to catch everybody to market. And I think that those are two other pieces that have come at least to my attention in this.
Mr. Chairman, I'd suggest that if somebody is at 100% of MPP, they're pretty fortunate. And what we've been doing is moving the bottom, if you will, up to 91%. So, yes, there are people. And if you're at 100% and you're unhappy because you haven't received a market increase for a while, my answer to that is tough. If you're at 92% of market, and you've been seeing people moved up from 85 to 87 to 91. Yeah, there's where you have the employees that are frustrated, again, because the people around them have been moving up to that 91% of market, and there they are just above it. That remains a problem. And so, Mr. Chairman, what we'll get to in Dean's description of the market increases, if we go into that explanation, you'll see that there are provisions within this proposal which would allow for limited market-based increases if you are above 91% of market. Again, dependent on your rating and dependent on how far away from market you are. I'll tell you that my guess is that if you're fairly close to MPP, and if you have only a competent rating, you aren't going to see much of an increase at all under this proposal.
You know, Mr. Chairman, it's one of the pieces that we've discussed in here is that you end up, and the reason I just brought it to everybody's attention is because every time we do something, you create a constituency. And of our public employees, that's about 27% of our public employees are the constituency who are MPP or above, who are vocalizing this piece. And that's just the constituency I wanted to remind that's out there.
You mean
You have about 9,000 employees, and 2,800 are at MPP or higher. And it's those 2,800 who are at the 100% of MPP or higher who have vocalized that they say, we have stayed stagnant longer as the Hay studies come in and identified people who are below MPP, and we brought 4,200 people up to 91%, still leaving 6,200 within the gap between 91 and 100, but 2,800 are above that gap, and that's the people who are saying, well, while everybody else is catching up, we've stayed flat for any number of years. And that's... It does speak, one, towards the one-time bonus, but it's also another piece to look at a one-time bonus across the board for everybody, because I tend to think that as we move this in, you either have to move it in probably on a pro rata for an 18-month basis, because when you talk about a $5 million piece, and the $550 per person. I'm giving you the two different points, and if you give a one-time bonus, which is far more preferential, I believe, because if you do it on a basis of market increases on their base salary, that goes into the standard budget, and we've already discussed that that's only on an 18-month time horizon because it's as of December 1st, so it's only 18 months, and so if you calculate $555 per person. On a possibility there, it's actually higher than that, as we know, because then it's going to end up being it'll be a third higher than that as we plug it in. So I'm advocating for the one-time bonus as what we try and work towards, as opposed to the other piece that's put in there. But I'm only bringing up the point that you have. Please. Certainly.
Their MVP have been plateaued for some time. Mm-hmm. They're deserving, and if you don't have a system like this, they get nothing.
They do get nothing. If you move, there are two pieces that you come into this with, Mr. Chairman, and what you end up with is representing two-thirds versus one-third of the total of people within there. And my illustration for discussion within the committee as we go to set policy, is that 20% of the people-ish will not be represented in any long-term raise, and they'll only be eligible for one-time bonus. However, do we need to make and as we go forward with these discussions, how do we set this as what folds into the standard budget and what doesn't? And I'm illustrating that there are two sides to this argument, and that we need to address them both and understand that those people want to have equal representation, both the 6,200 and the 2,800. Both have some good points in it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question on the performance level. Just to refresh my memory, is that a new twist to MPP? Have we done that in the past, that we mirrored performance?
Representative, this is a new approach. It was our understanding that rather than giving across-the-board increases to all employees, we built this system to be based on performance.
So as I see it, both in the merit and the market now, there's going to be a tremendous pressure on our performance standards and how our supervisors evaluate our employees. Are we comfortable that we have a solid system in place? And also, you know, what about those who want to dispute? And there's going to be more pressure for that to happen because, money's on the line now, and there's going to be a lot more pressure. And also the employee union, what kind of play will they have as we go forward with this? Because there's just going to be a lot more pressure on performance evaluations.
Representative, we do have a review process in our appraisal system. It's within the agency, and it can be appealed outside of the agency depending on the rating. So we do believe that with the changes to the new appraisal system, we do have a robust system, if you will, that that can truly measure performance. We also, in our appraisal process, have a review process where when a supervisor gives their employee an evaluation, it must be reviewed by someone else within the agency before it can stand. So there are multiple checks as far as review for fairness and equity within the agency. Ultimately, the responsibility does, though, come that the agency is responsible for the performance ratings, how they're distributed within the agency.
And I know, I mean, a lot of the evaluation has to do with the front end of it, setting, establishing the SMART goals by the supervisor with the employee. My understanding is those goals that just simply have to be measurable goals. That's the standard by which we, for all agencies. So there's still a lot of subjectivity, because one supervisor could have very simple measurable goals and another supervisor could have a lot more complex measurable goals. So is there any attempt at unifying? I mean, I know I heard you say that you're letting this happen agency by agency, and maybe we're just going to wait to see how all this shakes out over the next couple of years and see a need for more unified. In my mind, I would think that certain things like someone who consistently uses all of their sick leave within a year's time, that might be something we could actually use to knock them out of those two higher ratings, to just say, you know what, that's a measurable goal, and you consistently do that, so I don't know if I have a question. I may more just have a comment, Madam Chairman, but maybe we do need to. I don't know. I'm so concerned about the subjectivity and establishing the goals and then, of course, evaluating them.
Mr. Fawcett.
With any appraisal system, there will be subjectivity. I don't know how else to say that. What we have tried to do, working with employees' committees when we designed the system, was to reduce that subjectivity as much as possible. We do have agencies that are working to build standard criteria within groups of classifications. So, for example, all correctional officers, I'm using this as an example, could be evaluated on the same measures. Because the system is fairly new, not all agencies have done that, but that would be something that we would hope that would happen in the future. So this system does have lots of flexibility, and I do believe that this system will grow to be more robust and complex as the years come, to eliminate any subjectivity that there might be.
Thank you, Mr. Fawcett. And that partly is my concern, is just about being status quo, because when we discussed this reform, it was about that everyone isn't average and that it makes them to be incentivized to do a better job. So I guess that's where you come in now. Once you've gotten this, 90-some percent of these reviews in, you start reviewing that with the supervisor and those discussions occur. No?
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, pardon me, and Mr. Fawcett will answer this as well, but what's happened now is that the supervisor and the employee have talked about the year ahead. Here's what I'm expecting, and it is a communication. It's a collaborative. The employee has to sign and participate in the discussion of, here's what we're both agreeing needs to happen in the abbreviated period, 10 months ahead. Here's how it needs to be done. Here are the sorts of things that we're going to agree that we're going to measure, if you will, and rate in this period going forward. Also, they're sort of across the board things, like if somebody doesn't show up for work on time and things like that. Yes, that is also incorporated into these appraisals. There's a spot there essentially for that. So the conversation happens now. Here's what I'm expecting, and the employee saying, I agree, this is what I'm expected to do, and this is fairly amateurish in the way I'm describing it. And then there will be a meeting midway through the year where they review this, and then there will be a meeting towards the end of the period where the supervisor says, all right, well, this is what was expected to happen. This is my view of what has happened. Let's talk about it, and then you get the rating.
So then have you put in place a management tool so that it makes it easy for the supervisor and the employee to work this process through, so that it's documented easily? Because, I mean, you create a lot of paperwork when you're going through this process.
Madam Co-Chair, we have implemented an online appraisal system, so we have made steps to eliminate paper, if you will. So both the employee and the supervisor have participated in this process that Director Boswell talked about. One of the reasons we don't have 100% implemented today is the second part of the implementation of the appraisal. First, the supervisor sits down with the employee and discusses. The employee participates in defining the goals for the coming year. But before it can move forward in our appraisal system, the employee must log into the online system, review those, and if they wish, they can provide comment, and it does not move forward until the employee confirms that they've reviewed those performance goals for the coming year. So there's checks and balances in our current system. There are ways to measure and track this. We hope that during the planning process, if you will, with the employee participating in those measures, there's less subjectivity that the employee knows how they're going to be appraised in 9 months from now.
Good. Thank you for that process. Representative Harshman.
Madam Chair, just you're going to bring back some more information over the lunch hour, but perhaps if you have this information, just a little kind of a menu, that whole who's at 85 or 89, how many, and what would it cost? I mean, we might not have 5 or 10 million, but we might have some to kind of move folks who are the farthest somewhere. And so maybe give us a little menu of options there that we could see. Some kind of increments, you know. Does that make sense?
It does.
Thank you.
Further questions? Go ahead.
Is there a way to sort of implement a phantom plan and say, okay, let's here's your phantom dollars and distribute them, and we call them phantom stock plans. I mean, so you know, you could test drive it. You say here's your play money, if you will, and here's what would happen, and sort of evaluate the system afterwards. My biggest concern, I mean, if we run out, our first try is the actual implementation. Whatever happens, we're going to be back here a year and hear all of the reasons why it didn't work and why it couldn't work. Whereas if we said, okay, let's do a ghost run and say effective July 1, then get some feedback, make sure it worked, and then do the actual implementation rollout later.
Mr. Chairman, of course. You could do that. I think we all understand the fiscal realities, and it may be that this committee, the governor, and state government simply can't afford compensation adjustments, whether they be market, merit, or anything, or across the board if folks wanted to. I'll make a pitch that if the resources are available, and we can debate that endlessly, that it is important that there be a financial component built into what is happening now. This has happened so often over the years. If you do this, then we'll fund it with state employees in terms of performance appraisals processes over the years. And I recognize what you're saying with this, and it is absolutely reasonable to do something like this, Mr. Chairman, but I think it will erode the foundation of what we're trying to do in terms of create a vigorous performance appraisal system that both supervisor and employee takes seriously.
Let me restate what I meant, because, look, after Craig comes in, issues happen, there will be recommendations. I can look around my colleagues, and I can see some colleagues said, we don't care if you – I mean – Representative Harshman just said, look, if we only have X amount, let's first use it to get people up closer to MPP. I think there's some folks there who said, we don't care. We're going to go straight to this merit plan. We want to start implementing it. So my question is, suppose we leave here and we do put money in the merit plan, so it's going to happen, okay? So it's not a question of not happening. And following your recommendation, it's going to get implemented in December. Can we do a ghost run before, just to say, okay, here's, you know, on July 1, all things even, here's what would happen, and let it shake out so that the actual implementation follows a ghost run?
Mr. Chairman, I think to some degree we've done that. It's a bit of a, and so we could explore it again. It's a bit, I don't think I can say crapshoot over the air, so I better not. Mr. Chairman, without knowing what the actual appraisal ratings are going to be, it becomes a little difficult to model. But if we were to propose performance ratings in a given agency, and that might be one consideration of where we go in terms of a ghost of this, say the Department of Corrections, roughly 1,000 employees, all of them, virtually all of them general fund. And if you were to model a situation where a fair number of those employees got superior and commendable ratings, and we'd take the Department of Corrections on the merit side, we'd take the Department of Corrections portion of the total general fund budget in the 100 series, so we'd have that number in the current budget, shall we say. You would model the number of employees that would receive a superior or commendable rating. You could do it a couple of different versions, one that kind of sags too far to the happy, everybody's above average sort of thing. To some degree, yes, we could, stop me if I'm going too far, we can model the numbers of what it would be in the Department of Corrections, for example, in terms of a that sort of adjustment. It would be more difficult to do it in terms of market, Mr. Chairman, but.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman. I had two Red Bulls this morning. It's not my fault. But as I started to think about this more, and I wanted to get some feedback from the director about this, so when we start, let's say that, you know, you split the $10 million and $5 million is one time and $5 million is ongoing increase. And we've made a policy statement as a state that we want to get everybody to MPP. But now what we do is we have a portion of them who move to MPP, but what will end up happening is they'll come back because a portion of them still won't be at MPP because they didn't hit commendable or above on these pieces. And so in the end, we'll end up dragging everybody towards it. And so when we look at the ongoing piece versus the one time, if you went $5 million towards trying to just bring everybody to MPP, and then $5 million based on one time, because then it sticks with what we've been trying to do as a state, and that's bring everybody to MPP. Because if we do it, what we'll do is we'll do it for 2 years, everybody will creep up. And then we'll come back, a few people will creep up, you know, a small percentage of people who have been awarded as performing well. And then we'll come back, and then we'll still say that we have 4,000 employees who aren't at MPP, and then we'll throw more money in to get them all to MPP, and then those people who are doing well actually got a one-time thing, but then everybody caught up to them anyway. Or I'd rather got a merit-based increased pay, but as opposed to if you did one time with $5 million and then put $5 million towards trying to bring everybody as close to MPP as possible. Does that deviate too far from what you were trying to do, or what's your feedback on that?
Mr. Chairman, I'll preface this by saying that I really hope at some point Dean gets the chance to explain the second part of this proposal, because I don't think he's had the opportunity to do that yet, and I think that would help in this discussion. But, again, if you work from the theory that all compensation, and this is the theory that we're working from and that the governor has recommended, that all compensation adjustments include be based in at least to a degree on performance appraisal, based on performance, pardon me, rather than just by showing up, then I would disagree with what you're suggesting. And so what you're suggesting doesn't fit within the governor's recommendations. Is it reasonable? Of course it is, Representative, but it doesn't go where the governor was heading.
You know, I guess from my point of view, as I sit and listen to the discussion, it seems to me that agencies' heads have quite a bit of control to get their employees to MPP, hire men at MPP. If they have vacancies, they've got money, they can move them to MPP. And so that it's I'm not sure that we should accept, if you will, all the responsibility at the legislative level that we have to fund everybody to MPP when, in fact, agencies have a variety of techniques within their budgets to move employees to MPP. And you kind of say, hey, if we look at your 100 series, your 100 series has grown. And if you've grown them in numbers and sacrificed MPP, there's a responsibility for that. If you so you need to hire people in at MPP, you need to find your internal resources to get to MPP. And where I'm just talking out loud is that it may be that we say, look, getting to MPP is Dean's told you where it is. It's up to you to get your employees there. How you get there through attrition of employees, you reallocating resources or whatever, that's the agency director problem. And if we only had $5 million, maybe we just put it into the performance pay and implement it and leave it up to the agencies to figure out how to get to MPP over time.
Mr. Chairman, a caution about that, and again, I'm not particularly brilliant on this stuff, but what you wind up having then is a situation where agency directors are encouraged to work within the available funds within their budget to give their folks raises, and then all of us come in 2 years from now and wonder why the standard budget went up. And the reason the standard budget went up is they found a way within their current appropriations to almost certainly using vacancy savings within the 100 series to give people raises, get them closer to market, but then they filled the position. And the vacant position that they're realizing savings from, and you wind up with the creep of the standard budget. That's going to happen anyway, but that's the caution I'd have about the scenarios that you're suggesting. And, Mr. Chairman, I think it is perhaps an admirable goal to try to get to 100% of MPP. It would cost a fortune to get state employees to 100% of MPP. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen anytime soon. By some measures, we're likely to lose ground against MPP going forward. So as we talk about the goal of getting to MPP, to be honest with you, I think that's theory at this point. It's a nice thing to try to do out there in the future. But in terms of the next few years, and we talk about these compensation adjustments, it's a question of both trying to keep ourselves at that minimum, which is what 91% reflects, as well as in some fashion trying to recognize performance. And again, Mr. Chairman, I recognize the time, but if Dean could go through briefly the second half of the market.
The second component of what we'd like to discuss with you is how the market increases would be distributed to employees within the agency. And it's also on your handout on the right-hand column. In determining the amount of funds that would be available to an employee, it would be based on two criteria. One would be where the employee's actual pay is in comparison to market. And that's expressed as a ratio, and we call it a comp ratio. So what that means is that if employees are at 91% of market, their comp ratio is 91. The second component is that employees could only receive a market increase up to the market MPP that is defined. So we're not allowing employees to exceed market, nor are we allowing those above market to receive an increase. So no market increase is going to be rewarded to employees that are at or above MPP. Again, only the top three levels of performance would be eligible to receive a market increase: competent, commendable, and superior. The thinking on this is an employee who is not performing on their job should not receive a market increase. It does emphasize the fact, based on the governor's recommendation recognizing employees' performance, the higher level performers would be receiving the largest increases. But that is also dependent on how far they are from the market policy position. So if you would think of it in this term of a chart or a spreadsheet, the employee that is furthest from market and superior in performance, which is the highest level of performance, would receive the largest increase. An employee who is at a level of competent and closest to MPP would receive the smallest increase. So the increase and the amount of the increase is based on those two factors, where the employee is in relationship to the market and what their performance level is. And again, no market increase would be rewarded to employees that are less than competent. What we would do is based on the funding that's available, we would design a matrix, if you will, which would be applied consistently across all agencies. So the amount of distribution between a superior employee and a commendable employee would be consistent. The ratio would be. The dollar amount would be different because it would be dependent on the employee's actual performance rating again. So there is some consistency in the plan as far as how the funding would be distributed within that matrix, but the actual amount within agencies could vary from agency to agency depending on, again, the employee's rating. The comments at the bottom of this section are worth noting for both merit and market increases. Agencies will be eligible for the market and merit funding, and it's all based on the same criteria. So the way that we distribute the money would be the same. Each agency would get their proportional share. Employees would be eligible to receive market merit bonuses and market increases, but the driving factor on that is it's based on their overall performance rating. No agency can exceed the amount of money that's allocated to them, so that is one of the control factors. The way that we are distributing it, the funds, the way they would be consistent within the agency, but they may not be consistent between agencies. And what I mean by that is a superior employee in one agency may receive a dollar amount than an employee in another agency because of how that agency has distributed their performance ratings. The reason we do that, again, is that if one agency skews the ratings and, for example, rates all of their employees superior, and another agency takes a more conservative approach, it would reduce the dollar amount for all employees. What this then does is this does provide and make some accountability within the agency and the agency director for ensuring that those evaluations are conducted appropriately, and that would be then how we would distribute the funds.
Mr. Chairman, I'd note, I draw your attention to the ratings for merit and the eligibility under this proposal for merit one-time payments. A person receiving a rating of superior or commendable would be eligible. When it comes to the market side, that is increased. It goes one level further down: superior, commendable, and competent. And I just wanted to draw your attention to that.
What sort of a burden would it be to require that before the final payments are made, that the spreadsheet, if you will, is provided to the governor, and the governor initializes, signs off on it, so that the director says, here's my recommendations, and is at least required to go to the governor and show him what he wants to do, have the governor look at it and initial it?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think there's actually that much. If you're talking about the way the money is distributed within an agency, I don't think the agency director has a lot of flexibility there. The formula is developed within ANI, and it is applied into the agency. The agency's flexibility comes in determining the values, if you will, that go into the performance ratings. Are you talking, Mr. Chairman, about... Mm-hmm. first of all, yes, it's easy to do. But again, I'm not sure where the flexibility for each individual agency director would come the way we're describing it here, outside of crafting the focus of the performance appraisals. And it's going to be different from one agency to the next.
Yes. That's the one we gave in September?
Yes.
Yes.
To put it in our notebook so we'll have it in the right place.
Okay.
I'm not sure if everybody has command of it.
We've changed the matrix a little. I'll give you another example of what the new matrix looks
like.
That'd
be great if you'd update those. I'm thinking that, you know, I want you to have enough time to get some lunch. 1:15 or 1:30? 1:15, does that give you enough time, Dean, to get a bite to eat and be back?
Yep.
And get the stuff?
You'll have two Red
Bulls. Sue.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Visited with Bill a little bit earlier and Rosie as well about the issue of I'm pretty much totally keeping track of things on my computer, and all these handouts are getting difficult to manage. And so as well as paper copies for those of us who want to just link to documents, it would be really great if we also just got a link that we could connect to for all handouts.
A link to the agency, or you want to bring an electronic copy?
Send us an electronic copy or give me a link if it's already posted out there somewhere. I don't care which.
Excuse me. Mr. Chairman, it would make it a lot simpler for me if you two as chairman would issue the edict that we need 20 paper copies and send me personally an electronic file, whether it's PDF or whatever it is, of whatever it is anybody from here forward bring to me at this point, because I'll tell you, things are getting turned around, so I just think it came to me.
We'll issue a letter that says from here on out what our expectation is to get a the requisite number of hard copies and have the PDF emailed to you, and so that we get a PDF copy, and then you can just fast forward it to folks, and it'll be easier to build our database. And you sure you want it to be you? I mean, I know that you just sit up there waiting for that email to come in.
Mr. Chairman, the mail never stops on my computer. But I actually, in this case, even though I don't really look forward to getting all of those emails, the control freak in me is coming out about this stuff. And
well,
I want them to come
to me. Ultimately, maybe what we could do is, think about it. Before we put the letter out, if we had them put a requisite subject matter on it, then you could code it to go into a directory so that they'd be collected. Why don't you think? Ask the IT guys, unless you already know the answer, to make sure that we require a specified name on the subject matter so that you could create a feature that would maybe not only put it in a directory, but automatically forward it to others.
That's, Mr. Chairman, that is a great idea.
Why don't you do that? Let's do the instructions, and we'll sign it.